Good morning, honorable members. Let me welcome everybody who is here. And because of the time constraints, we might not be able to go through the normal process of the introduction. We're starting slightly late because we were trying to sort out some of the programming issues. That included us having to speak to the office of the chief whip as well as the chair of chairs. I think Honorable Mackenzie was with me when I was calling Honorable Florick. On this matter of the committees that are supposed to be sitting tomorrow and they schedule their meetings today. I think the resolution that they've taken is very simple and straightforward, is that members, as they are aware of the rules, they are supposed to follow the rules. During committee week, the slot changes. Instead of Wednesday, we'll be meeting Tuesdays, as we have always been doing. And that if we want to meet on Wednesday, we'll have to meet in the afternoon of Wednesday. That has always been the practice, but then you have the odds, like the Portfolio Committee on Sports has convened a meeting today. I don't know if Energy is convening, but the understanding was that from their secretary, they are not meeting. They'll start at 2. I know that the Select Committee on Energy is meeting now, which has got nothing to do with the NA, it's the NCOP. I'm raising this thing so that members must assist us in this regard. For chairpersons to stick to the rules, members themselves first must follow the rules. Because it's incumbent upon members that if the hour slot is on a Tuesday morning during the committee week, we must come to our committees that are scheduled for that. If it's our slot, it's a traditional Wednesday, when it's parliamentary week, then we then attend accordingly. Otherwise, the chairperson, as long as they receive members, as long as members attend, they will continue, you know, creating this problem. So at the end, you don't have a quorum when you are supposed to meet. Unfortunately, the meeting that I promised you for, which was supposed to take place on Thursday, of the chairperson of the chair of the committee of chairpersons, did not take place because the chair of chairs had to attend to a business outside of the country. So it is still coming. Hopefully, in that meeting, we'll take a final position whether to amend the rules so that we stick to one day throughout, or we stick to the current arrangement. I'm just raising this so that you are aware that there have been these interactions trying to sort this matter out. I don't want to take too much of the time. I would allow the department. Are there any apologies? Yes.
Good morning. There are three apologies. One from Advocate Schmidt. He's attending the Judicial Service Commission. Another one from Honorable Lucas. He's unable to attend due to prior commitments. And the last one is from Honorable Matebe. She's on sick leave. Thank you.
Thank you very much. As we have agreed, whoever else is not here without an apology will be recorded as absent. Because we're trying now to deal with the formal procedural issues. I'm going to hand over to the department to take us through. Remember that we have collapsed the two presentations into one. The one of the non-financial performances as well as the one of the financial performance. You will decide which one you want to start with. Give us all of that and then we engage until the end of the meeting today. We've got nothing else on the agenda except that matter. Over to you, Acting DG. Okay.
thank you, Honorable Chair, and good morning to all the members. My name is Edson Ragimana, the acting DG as the chair indicated. Chair, I think it's befitting at this occasion to just indicate that in this capacity of acting DG, this would probably be my last interaction with the committee, as members would be aware that an announcement was made about the appointment of the new Director General, who is Dr. Ramonja, who should be joining us very shortly. So I thought it's appropriate that we just make that announcement up front.
So it means the old lady.
Yeah,
on your part.
I'm out of a job.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Chairperson. Honorable Chair and members, we are presenting our annual report and audited financial statements at a time when our department has received a modified audit opinion, which is a matter of concern for us. The GMR is presenting its first annual report post the split of the erstwhile Department of Minerals and Energy. During this split process, or after subsequent to the split, in the meantime, Chair, that's a quick introduction while we're circulating. Yeah, it's working, but the notes are not on the presentation. So we're circulating hard copies of them. Our apologies, Chair, for that. Chair, I must indicate that the process of separating the Department of Mineral Resources from the Department of Energy has taken its course and, as we reported previously, has now been concluded. But it did result in some vacancies in key positions, which we are now happy to report that those positions have now been filled. So partly the audit outcomes that we are sitting with today can be attributable to the gaps that were created because of the vacancies that were there at the time in those key positions. And before we present and take questions relating to the audit report and the non-financial information, it is important to provide a context to some of the silent issues pertaining to the work of the department. The government, through DMR, was charging royalties in respect of state-owned minerals, and that changed with the new Royalties Act, which applied to the right to mine. The Royalty Act, as members would be aware, came into effect on the 1st of March 2010. We will be elaborating further on this during the presentation of our financial as well as audit report. When we presented the DME annual report for 2009 and 10, we also tabled an action plan aimed at addressing issues raised by the Auditor General. Acknowledgement of this, the progress and the impact of this plan is articulated in the AG's report for the year under review. Having said that, we want to reassure and we will continue on the same path with the view of getting to an unqualified audit report. As part of this briefing, we will also provide an update on the filling of vacant positions, which indicate that over 87% of funded positions are already filled. I need to also indicate that the process of filling these vacant positions are at various stages, and the report will indicate such. In line with the President's directive of filling vacant and funded positions within 6 months of them becoming vacant, we are pleased to let you know that on average, it currently takes the department approximately 4 months to fill vacant positions. Honorable members, last year we announced in this August half our strategy on improving competitiveness of the South African mining industry, namely the mining growth strategy. Elements of this strategy, which is a product of the work of MIGDET, aimed at positioning our mining industry along a new trajectory for sustainable growth. In its work, MICDET sought to also address constraints to growth, infrastructure, as well as mineral regulatory issues. As a consequence of this, the streamlining of administrative processes as recommended by MICDET led to the development of a new mineral regulation and administration system, or SAMRA. The need was for transparency, demystifying availability of resources, broader access to application process, uniform and standard adjudication, resource allocation, and accountability for decisions, as well as to plan resource allocation relative to other land use and conservation objectives. I apologize. The online application phase of the system was officially implemented on 18 April 2011. Since its implementation, over 2,000 applications covering categories of rights and permits were successfully lodged on the new system, signaling both the confidence and the potential it holds for mining in South Africa. With any new system that is being developed, there are often initial challenges that are experienced, and ours was not unique to this. This included accessibility, traffic volumes, and general issues of the system. We would like to assure the honorable members that these challenges continue to receive our most urgent attention, and we are committed to improve the constantly address this until our objectives are achieved. The system will further be enhanced with new models relating to enforcement, revenue management, and performance reporting tools, as well as an overall organizational performance model. As part of a plan on refining our administrative processes, we imposed a moratorium on the lodgement of new prospecting rights in September 2010, which was uplifted in April 2011 in all provinces except Mpumalanga, which subsequently followed at the end of September. The consequence of imposing this moratorium, as well as diversion of resources away from adjudication of applications towards compliance inspections, led to delays in finalizing some of the applications. A plan has now been put in place to eradicate this before the end of this year. The minister intends releasing a report with regard to the findings relating to Mpumalanga, as well as progress made with regard to the findings from the whole exercise. Our department has witnessed an increase in the number of conflicts between mining companies and host communities. Some of these would have been witnessed by honorable members during their oversight visits to various areas. I want to assure the members that these are being followed up with a view of addressing issues as being raised. We have finalized the review of the mining charter, and I'm aware that honorable members had an opportunity to engage extensively on this process. The charter, as it is currently, represents a much more improved version of the charter, which includes a scorecard for reporting and monitoring purposes. We also obtained cabinet approval for the work aimed at setting up the state-owned mining company, and further work is in progress in this regard. Chair, I must indicate that linked to all of this, we have also started, and the work is at a very further stage in terms of the amendments to the MPRDA. We have just gone through the process of getting the state law advisor to give comments on the amendments. Proposed amendment, so it should be going to cabinet in a very short while. Members would recall that some of the issues that we have committed to address ranged from issues around removing ambiguities in the law, making provision for comprehensive consultation process, as well as enhancing some of the punitive measures for non-compliance. So those are some of the amendments that we will be bringing forward. During the year under review, we recorded the lowest number of fatalities in the history of South African mining industry, a total number of 127 persons lost their lives compared to 168 in the previous year. Having said that, the department remains concerned about the continued loss of life at our mines, and we will continue to take a hard stance against unsafe working conditions. The approach for today, Honorable Chair, will be that we will start with the presentation on the financial performance, which will then be followed by the program-specific presentation, where we will be giving more details on some of the issues that we have covered in the introduction. So, because of time constraints, we will request that as the members from the DMR team either present or have to add something, and they would then have to introduce themselves first. Yeah,
so can you introduce your team?
Or can we
do that? Just referring to the normal introduction of everybody in the house.
Oh, okay. No, we thank you for that. I think I've already indicated I'm Edson Wagimana, the acting DG.
Good morning, Chair. I'm also one of I'm David Nsiza, the Chief Inspector of Mines.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Joel Rapier. I'm the DDG, Deputy DG, responsible for mineral regulation within the department.
Machiron members, my name is Petrol Nemagovani, Chief Director, Audit Services.
Good morning, I'm Joseph Katanga, Chief Director, responsible for strategy, risk management and monitoring.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Peter August. I'm Chief Director, Legal Services in the Department of Mineral Resources.
Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Thabo Dube, Deputy Chief Inspector.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. My name is Dirk O'Neill. I'm Acting Deputy Director General, Mineral Policy and Promotion.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Member. I am Irene Chifura, Chief Director of Finance and Supply Chain Management, but currently acting CFO.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honorable Members. My name is Pat Gamede, DDG Corporate Services.
Good morning, Chair, Honorable Members. My name is Andre Tronier. I'm Chief Director, Mineral Regulation for Western Region.
Good morning, Chairperson and Honorable Members. My name is Mutlatso Kobe. I'm the Chief Director, Mineral Regulation, responsible for Limpopo in Mpumalanga.
Good morning, members. My name is Vuyiswa Mangu. I'm the CEO in the Ministry of DMR.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Zinga Kisakuja. I'm the Director of Communications in the department.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Herman Cornelissen. I'm from MinTech, Senior Researcher there. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Henk Kutsia. I'm a Specialist Scientist at the Council for Geoscience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, with your permission, we would like to start with the presentation on the financial performance, which will cover the annual financial statement, the report of the Auditor General, together with the action plan that we've put in place to deal with the issues raised there. We have also incorporated a report on the losses that are reported in the financial statements, giving further breakdown on that. A report on Akua, as reported also by the Auditor General. We've also included the progress on our on the implementation of the budget review report. And lastly, we will touch on the Section 82 report, which will reflect the status of our expenditure against budget as well as revenue against projection up to the end of September 2011. In terms of this year's, or rather the year under review on the financial statement, we felt that it would be appropriate to just first project a picture that showed how we performed in terms of the funds that we were allocated and that were appropriated by this house. In terms of the overall spending, we were allocated a budget of 995.8 million, and we've managed to spend 994.6 of that, which leaves us with a variance of 1.1 million. And this variance mainly comes from Program 1, where there is an underspending of 1.1 million, and the rest of the programs are sitting at quite neglectable variances there. And the key reason why we are having this underspending relates to the issue of some of the invoices that were either received at year-end but had not yet been finalized in terms of processing, or instances where services or goods were rendered but no invoicing had taken place as yet. So this figure is also included as part of the accruals, which I will speak to a little bit later on. The next two slides, slide 5 and 6, are actually just capturing the points that I've just mentioned. So we'll move on to slide 7, which talks to the trend on the utilization of voltage funds. Here we've just given it a picture to show that even from the time when we were DME up to 2010-11, which is the year that we are reporting on now, our level of underspending has been sitting at less than 3% consistently, so which is quite below the material underspending level that in the Treasury guidelines is reflected as such. So we are quite happy, pleased that we have been managing our budget in such a way that we don't sit at the end of the year with huge sums of money that are not spent on programs that have been approved by this house. If we can just move on to the next slide. As I already indicated, we are below 3%. The unspent funds reasons there relate to the receiving of invoices, and the point around the linkage between accruals and unspent funds, we'll elaborate a little bit more on that at a later stage. On the next slide, here we have taken each statement within the annual financial statement and projected it against our prior spending. We do recognize here, however, that we are comparing, if you like, Honorable Chair, apples with oranges, because in 2009-10 we were DME, while in 2010-11 we are Mineral Resources. But we felt that just to give a sense to the committee of how our expenditure relates to that of the previous year, we would use this information because that is the best comparison that we have available. We didn't want a situation where we would just show a zero for 2019. And in terms of the Treasury guidelines on the split, DMR has been designated as the hosting or the transferring department from the, which means we take over everything that was in the old DME in terms of assets, liabilities, and so forth, and we transfer the portion that relates to energy back to them. So in terms of reporting the comparative figures, ours will show prior as those that belong to the DME. So here we are seeing some interesting trends there in terms of variances, and I will focus just on those areas that have got significant variances, where issues like periodic payments are reflecting a decline there of 87%, venues and facilities at 58%, advertising, communication. So we will elaborate a bit more on those variances in the next two slides. Then continuing on the same analysis, we are also seeing there some significant trends around declining financial transactions in assets and liabilities, transfers and subsidies also going down by 88%, building and other fixed structures, and lastly, machinery and equipment. And here we've just given some text in terms of the reasons why the asset decline, obviously read within the context of us coming from the DME environment. So we are seeing here staff costs having declined as a result of the split from the Department of Minerals and Energy, where the numbers are shown there on the slide on what we used to be and what we were at the end of the financial year. Linked to that, our goods and services costs have also reduced subsequent to the split. However, what is of interesting to note is that expenditure relating to leases has increased slightly, and this is due to the relocation of some of our regional offices together with the head office, which took place during the 2010 financial year. The decrease in tangible capital assets is also mostly attributable to leasehold improvement, which is because of customizing the accommodation to fit our needs. So in 2009 and 10, because we were preparing for the 2010 relocation, we had a higher cost during that financial year, which then went down in the subsequent year. The decrease of 88% in transfers and subsidies relates to those transfers that were made while we were still DME. For example, I think for noting here would be transfers relating to the electrification program that is run by the Department of Energy, which I think at the time of the split was accounting for over 2 billion of the DME budget. So most of those have now moved over to the Department of Energy. Financial transactions, we've seen a decline of 94%. This is due to a reduction in losses that were written off during the year. And I think here I just need to pause and explain that at a later point we will be talking about the losses that the AGS has reported on assets. And the question that might arise is to say, you are reporting a decline of 94% here, while on the other side there is this amount of assets that have been lost. This is mainly due to the reporting standard, which requires us to write off financial losses of our income statement. In other words, it comes out of our budget. However, when you've lost an asset that was acquired in the past, it's a simple disclosure note, so it doesn't come onto the face of your financial statement. So these are related but two different issues. On the next slide, we then do the same comparison on the statement of financial position, where we are seeing decline in the balance for cash and cash equivalents, prepayments, voted funds to be surrendered, as well as revenue to be surrendered, and I will provide more explanations on the next slide in terms of the reason for that.
we can just move on to slide 50. 18. Slide 50. We apologize. I'll ask members to just refer to the hard copy printout on slide 15. It looks like it's not appearing on the screen. I'm not sure what technology is doing to us. Here we have noted that there's been a decrease in the asset base of 84% from the previous year. And this is mainly linked to the reduction in our bank balance at year end, which was sitting at about, the difference was around 121 million. And this is mainly due to the underspending that was high in the previous year relative to the current year. You would recall, Honorable Chair, that in the last report that we did as DNC, we had over 100 million underspent. And as much as in percentage terms, it was less than 3%. In terms of the monetary value, it was quite a significant figure at the time. So we have now seen that decline of about 84%. And as far as prepayments and advances are concerned, there's a decline of 99%. These were funds that we were sitting with where there was a prepayment done to MINTEC for the rehabilitation of ownerless and derelict mines prior to us reclassifying that money as a transfer payment to MINTEC. And because they then had to complete the work, we could only release that prepayment on the balance sheet after the work was completed and we had received a report to say we have signed off on this. So that has now been cleared. The decline on current liabilities relates to us being able to utilize the 99.9% of our appropriated funds. Because what happens is when you have money that you have not spent, you then have to report that as voted funds to be surrendered, which becomes a liability for the department, recognizing that you have to pay that money back into the revenue fund. So the same effect then happens to say if you have lower level of underspending, then your current liabilities related to voted funds to be surrendered would be lower. So that is the reason there. Going further to slide 16, again, I would ask members to look at the hard copy presentation. On that one, we have got royalties that were collected amounting to 51 million that we had to put under payables while we were busy with the process of discussing with the South African Revenue Services in terms of the treatment of that royalty amount. In my introductory note, I did indicate that the Royalty Act came into effect from 1 March 2010. So that then had we had to take a decision in terms of subsequent receipts that came to the DMR in the form of royalties. Furthermore, the recoverable expenditure amount, which is made up of 7.6 relating to an old case of fraud which happened in 2008, where the processes of recovering that money are basically running through the asset forfeiture unit. This money, I can indicate that we know that the money is there in the bank account. When we picked up the fraud, we were able to communicate with the banks and they immediately froze the accounts into which this amount were transferred. However, in terms of the process of releasing that, it's a lengthy process that requires a number of steps to be done, which includes even going to get a decision from a court in terms of for the banks to be able to release the money so that they don't subsequently have somebody coming to claim that money and say it was taken away from their account illegally. The other part relates to claims against our sister department of energy. which links to an agreement which we signed with them at the point of visit, where we felt that we agreed that some of the services that we were sharing, it would not make economic sense for them to have a team that is working on those type of services like accommodation in the regional offices. So we agreed that we would continue to be the key point of entry or the key tenant, and anything that we pay would then be apportioned on the basis of occupation. And this is then the balance that we were sitting with at year end, which they still had to reimburse us. Moving further to slide 17, and now this is appearing on the screen. This is a breakdown of all the transfers and subsidies that we have done. The names of the entities or the recipients on the left-hand side, the actual transfer, as well as the purpose. So majority of these represent core funding for our state-owned entities, while the two that are probably outside of that norm is the $30 million that we transferred to MINTEC for rehabilitation, as well as $23 million that was transferred to IDC in respect of small scale mining. The next slide then talks to the issue of the Auditor General's report. And I think here, before we get deeper into the action plan and the analysis, just to reflect that on the qualified audit opinion or the modified opinion that we received from the agency, they are essentially two issues. And what appears here is a reflection of the type of reporting that is required in terms of the auditing standard, where they have to report if there's an error and it affects five different accounts, they have to report on each account balance. So if one then looks at the report from the Auditor General, from paragraph 7 all the way up to paragraph 11, those issues relate to one issue, which is revenue and receivables. So it affects your receivables balance, it affects your revenue that is reported in the income statement, it affects the payables because of the situation that I indicated, where we had to keep some of the money in the payables pending a decision on how that should be treated. And then lastly, it affects the provision. So here, the key issue that the AG is raising this year is that they were unable to confirm the receivables balance that we've reported, which is sitting at about $72 million. And the main root cause for that is that when they were auditing, there were instances where they recalculated the interest that is payable or receivable to the department by the different license owners, and they were not able to arrive at the same figures that we did. And this is due to the fact that we don't have a revenue management system within the department. This work has been primarily done on Excel spreadsheets. So as a result, we were unable to satisfy the Auditor General that our calculations were correct. There has been instances where they picked up some amounts that were received but were not reflected on the spreadsheet, although in terms of our financial reporting system, such amounts would have been reported as revenue correctly. So for that reason, they then concluded that they cannot confirm that the balance that we have shown as receivables and the amount that we are reporting as revenue, the payables that we've disclosed, as well as the provisions that we've made, are a correct reflection of what those amounts should be. So this is the first issue. The second issue then relates to contingent liabilities. Honorable members would be aware that we have this program where we have committed to do rehabilitation of ownerless and derelict mines. We have reported progress in terms of the development of the database, the development and approval of the strategy. However, in terms of now quantifying this liability, there has been a time where a figure of 30 billion was reported. And unfortunately, that was useful in terms of giving a sense of what this liability potentially could be. But it's not the type of figure or calculation that could be used for audit purposes. Because then we have to go through the process of saying what is the basis, what are the assumptions, and so forth. And that would not have passed the standards that are published by National Treasury for us to disclose that as a contingent liability or as a provision. So those are essentially the two issues that the qualified opinion is based on. So we have then, on that, with that background, we've then looked at what was the situation in 2019, what is the situation now, and where have we missed the plot. So this slide on the left-hand side, it shows the findings from the AG in 2009 and 10. The middle shows the findings in the current year, and then the last column then indicates, shows you what our observation is in terms of what the new issues are and the proposed way forward in terms of resolving that. So when we came here last year, we had committed to a number of actions to resolve the prior findings, which was around receivables for departmental revenue, where they had said it's incomplete, inconsistent, and inaccurate. So we committed to doing monthly reviews with all the regional offices. We committed to appoint staff with finance knowledge and experience at regional offices. We committed to developing a revenue management system. As we stood on the 31st of March 2011, we had implemented all of this action plan except the last one. And the reason why the development of the system could not be finalized on time was that we then had to decide which one do we prioritize, because there was a need, as I alluded to earlier on, out of our mixed process. We were constantly getting complaints from investors who were saying that your administrative systems are not helping in terms of the license application processes. So we had to then prioritize that, and the product of that was the Samrat online system. Unfortunately, this then consumed all our resources, both in terms of the time that we had to dedicate to developing the system, as well as the financial resources that had to be prioritized from certain areas. So the decision was then to say, let's then postpone the development of the revenue management system to the 2011-12 financial year. As we speak right now, this work is underway. The user requirements and the functional specs have been developed. We just need to now start with the actual development work. And we are confident that by end of this calendar year, this model will be up and running, so that when we come back here, we are no longer sitting with a modified opinion. Moving further to the next finding, and this finding on the invoices not paid within 30 days, we do acknowledge that this is a matter that was reported in the previous year as well. Last year we have committed to having a centralized system for managing invoices. We had committed to doing monthly reports on contracts versus orders. We had committed to reviewing the confirmation of payment process. And all of these have been implemented. However, there is one aspect that we believe is the reason why we are still unable to achieve this 30-day turnaround time. And that has to do with the sign-off by responsibility managers on the confirming that indeed the work in as far as services are concerned has been done. So there is a new process that we are busy implementing, which would entail that as soon as a service provider has rendered a service, they would need to get sign-off in a prescribed format from the program manager, which will then be attached to the invoice to ensure that when the invoice gets submitted, there is no longer a delay in the processing of that payment, because the current system then creates problems where there are disagreements on whether the service provider is billing the correct amount or not. The next point, on the next slide, we talk about reporting on irregular expenditure. It was a finding in the previous year. We have since beefed up our systems, and in the current year, this finding is no longer in the AG's report. Next is the finding which links to the qualified audit opinion, which is also a new finding on the contingent liabilities. And this is what we're talking about relating to the obligation for the rehabilitation of derelict and ownerless mines. And here we have already started engagement with the Council for Geoscience, where they have given us a plan in terms of how this work can be concluded successfully in such a way that when we come back here again, this is no longer an issue. I must indicate that in the past, we have never had a problem with this particular area in as far as accounting for it is concerned. However, the AG's view is that if we are moving towards accrual accounting, we need to start quantifying all our provisions, and therefore this has to be one of those areas that need to be done urgently. We do realize that it's going to cost money, money which we could have probably applied in terms of doing further rehabilitation work, but we have reprioritized some of the funds to take care of that situation. The next issue on the findings relates to ACUA, where the Auditor General has taken the total on our ACUA, added them to the, or rather deducted them, added them to the funds that we have, compared them with the funds that we had available at year end, and the conclusion is that had all the invoices been paid within 30 days, we would have been sitting with an unauthorized expenditure in the manner that some of our, or rather the sum total of our ACUA would have exceeded the available budget at year end. We do recognize that this is a problem, and it largely talks to the adequacy of funding that we have, particularly for goods and services. And our intervention on this one, we have already put through a motivation to the National Treasury to request for funding in those areas where we are having challenges. And we are in the process of introducing further cost containment measures on goods and services over and above what we've already done in the past. Then we move on to the specific areas that the committee has requested us to report on. On material losses, we are sitting with a 5.8 million loss on our disclosure note, and this represents assets that could not be verified when we did our final verification process at year end. So we have now given different categories as requested by the committee to indicate what these assets are and what is the book value. So what you have on the third column is the amount at which the assets were acquired some years ago, and the book value is what they were worth at the time of when the loss took place. In other words, if we were to sell those, what were we likely to be able to recover? And this is not taking into account the market values. This is simple depreciation, where we just take the cost and divide by the useful lifespan. So these are mostly assets that were towards the end of their lifespan. The first category there represents assets that we were unable to verify for two or more years. And this category is an interesting one here in the sense that it also represents weaknesses in the system that we were using for accounting for assets. Just to give a demonstration, where you have an asset tag put on an asset, if for some reason that tag falls out and then the verification team comes in and they find that there is an asset without an asset tag, when they did a replacement on the tag, they would come and paste a new tag and go back and recognize that asset as an additional asset on the register. So what you end up with is that there's one asset that is accounted for twice. So as part of this verification process, we then had to go and look at those duplications and made sure that we eliminated them. So that is the first category. The second category are those assets that were lost during the relocation process. I must say that the relocation was of such a large scale that when we were planning around it, there were certain risk factors that we couldn't have anticipated at the time. And I believe that there is indeed room for improvement in this area. But I must also state that because this coincided with the split of the Department of Minerals and Energy into two, some of these assets, I can confidently indicate that as at year end, we were able to pick up about over $1 million worth of assets that were sitting in the Department of Energy but could not be picked up during the accounting period. So there is a number there that is not an actual loss, but we then agreed with the Auditor General that because it was picked up at a time where the audit had to be finalized, we had to just reflect it as an unadjusted misstatement. So in this current year, when we report, we would have to deduct that from our opening balance because it's currently sitting there. So we'll have to do a reflection on that because it becomes an addition and a subtraction at the same time. So the net effect would be zero. So this loss here could be significantly lower than the number that is reflected here. Those are the main categories. The others are more fixed structures where you've got things that when you relocate from a building, you can't move with. So as part of the process, you have to write those off. The other was a correction of classification where we had recognized some list assets as our own and we had to then take those out of the register. And then the last category relates to actual losses that were reported by officials and either a write-off had to take place or there was supposed to be a recovery of some sort. In terms of the next slide, we then talk to the action plan on dealing with the issue of losses. As I already alluded to the first point, this talks to the issue of duplications in the asset register. So those on the right hand side talk to the interventions that we are going to put around the tech replacement process, the IT equipment handling. And then on the assets that went missing during relocation, we need to just beef up our project management in terms of future relocation so that the element of safeguarding assets is key in that process and we are able to minimize the losses in that process. Going further on this one, I will not spend too much time because these are the most sort of significant facts, and most of those action plans that are indicated on the right have already been implemented. So this talks to making sure that when we record fixed structures, they are recorded under the correct item. This has now, through our engagement with National Treasury, have now been added on our standard chart of accounts, and we are able to recognize those as improvements and no longer as movable assets. On the next slide, this is where now we talk a little bit more about the Akua. We were sitting with a 1.1 million unspent funds at year end, which according to the report of the AG was not sufficient to cover all the accruals raised. So we've just gone back to look at the history around our unspent funds versus accruals. So in 2009 and 10, we were sitting with 19 million of accruals, while unspent funds was sitting at 11.5 million. So we would have had an unauthorized expenditure of 8.1 million. And then in the year under review, the relationship is 37 million versus 1.1. Should be 1.1, not 3.8. So where we then have a deficit of 33 million. So this is a serious concern to us, and we would really request this committee to also look at this issue during the budget process. The unauthorized expenditure that would have been incurred, as indicated, is already an indication of serious challenges in terms of our allocation for goods and services. And we unfortunately are one of those departments that are not project-driven. Our work revolves around people as well as their ability to have the tools of trade and be able to travel to do inspections and assessments during the entire application process. We then go on to talk to our progress made in implementing the budget recommendation. The first one was talking to the minister, having to ensure that there is capacity within the department and providing the necessary resources, including the budget. What we could do from our side was to put together a proposal and submit it as part of the budget process to the National Treasury to request more funding. We do recognize that we are operating in an environment where there is a limited funding nationally. There is talk even currently of a double dip recession. So we think that this situation is not going to get better anytime soon. But then in the next slide, we just want to share with the committee in terms of the relationship between what we requested and what was then allocated as additional funding. For 2010-11, this would have happened during the year 2009-10, because we always plan the budget process a year ahead. We requested 281 million, and only about 10 million was allocated. 2011-12 requested 452 million, and we only allocated 10 million. This allocation only talked to the allocation that comes to the DMR in terms of capacity, not those areas where we would have received funding, for example, for the water issue, that money which subsequently had to go to MINTEC. So these are the type of funds that we have been allocated additional. And that unfortunately also has to cover the annual salary increases that get negotiated at the bargaining council. The next recommendation, to ensure that DMR's contribution to the process of creating decent jobs and ensuring sustainable livelihood needs to be set up through beneficiation and small-scale mining strategies. We do acknowledge that there was a bit of delay, but Cabinet has now approved the beneficiation strategy as a policy for the country on the 8th of June. The process of developing implementation plans for the prioritized value chain has already started. We are happy to indicate that on the first two value chains that were due now in October in terms of the Cabinet Lekgotla resolution, the work has already been completed internally within DMR. Those are now in the Cabinet processes where they have to go to the cluster, the Cabinet Committee, and subsequently we are confident that they are going to be approved. So the next three value chains are going to be finalized early next year as in line with the Cabinet Lekgotla resolution. As far as the small-scale mining strategy is concerned, the work has already been done on this. There is a draft strategy that we have engaged between myself and the team, and there are just some changes that need to be made before it can finally go to the minister for final approval. So again, here we are confident that by the end of this calendar year, we should be reporting that this is done. The next recommendation talks to the issue of capacity, and this links to the previous one around funding, because we've always reported that the challenge is that we know what capacity we need to be operating at. We know how much it's going to cost, but we are unable to secure the necessary funding that is required to be able to fund the vacancies. So the structures are already there in terms of what we would want to have. But until such funding is made available, we would not be able to fund those vacancies. The next recommendation was for the Director General to ensure that the committee receives the organogram for the DMR. We will be touching on that at a later point when my colleague, Ms. Gamed, does a presentation on the issue around vacancies. We are aware that the organogram that we circulated was not very clear in terms of what was printed out. But I can just also indicate that on page 4 of the annual report, where it talks about general information, we have given a high-level organizational structure of the DMR. So that might also be helpful in terms of clarifying what the DMRs should be looking like. Linked to that, we'll also be talking to a report on the vacancies. And then the last part that I'm going to be presenting on before my colleagues come in with the program performance is the request from the committee for us to present on the Section 32 report. And slide 33 gives a picture in terms of where we are at the end of September 2011, where in terms of our projection, we had projected that by that time we would have spent $583 million, and the actual was sitting at $519 million, which represents a variance of 11%. Now, one of the observations from here is that we are comfortable that
at the end of September, which represents the first 6 months in the financial year, we were sitting at 50% of our total budget allocation in terms of expenditure. So our projections were slightly over-ambitious in terms of where we would have wanted to be. If we had spent the 11%, we would have been sitting just slightly under 60% of the total budget allocation. So we constantly monitor these things to make sure that our spending is in line with the projections, because we understand the impact this has on the national budget framework in terms of managing cash flow. So the underspending there mainly relates to three key areas, which are indicated in the next slide. The first one being the transfer to the IDC for small-scale mining, as I indicated earlier on that work on the small-scale mining strategy has already commenced. There is a draft strategy which just needs to go for final approval. The other key area relates to assistance to mines. As honorable members would be aware that we can only make these transfers to operating mines. So at the moment, some of those marginalized mines that we were making transfers to are non-operational as we speak, so we were unable to make those transfers. The other part relates to work on the rehabilitation of ownerless and derelict mines, which in terms of this, it's indicated as falling under MINTEC, but it's a combination of MINTEC and the Council for Geoscience. So the Council is going to be helping us with the planning work, as I indicated earlier on. We are at the final stages of signing the contract in terms of the work that they need to do. And as soon as that is done, we'll be able to transfer the money through to them. On MINTEC, we had some delays in terms of community engagement in areas that had to be rehabilitated. And most of those issues have now been resolved. We are now in a position to continue with the work that had to be done on this program. So in terms of goods and services, there is an underspending there which relates to an amount of 6.6 million that has to be paid over to the Department of Public Works for office accommodation. And this is an old issue that we have reported on before, to say as part of ensuring good governance and good internal control system, we do scrutinize the invoices that come from our sister department, and where we pick up that there are certain things that are not consistent with what we are expecting to see, we then don't just transfer the money without those issues being resolved. So we are working with the Department of Public Works to ensure that that issue is resolved before year end. The other side then talks to some vacancies that we have, which my colleague will speak to in the presentation on vacancies. So in terms of the action plan, although I have sort of talked to each of the areas, we need to fast track the finalization of the strategy, the signing of the agreements with the Council for Geoscience, so that we can then spend that money accordingly. And lastly, in terms of the projections on revenue, because of the introduction of the Royalties Act, we had reduced our projections significantly to about 9 million in the first half of the year. But in terms of the actuals, we collected a little bit more than what we anticipated. So we are quite happy that we are able to collect more than what we projected. But in order to bring the projections closer to the actual, as part of the adjusted budget process, we have now realigned or changed our projections so that
in the remaining 6 months, we would be having a much more closer relationship between the two. Yeah, that concludes the presentation on the financial performance. With your permission, we'll then move on to program one, where we'll start with finance, followed by corporate services, and then we'll go to program two, three, and lastly four.
Maybe because this is quite a volume of information, let's handle any questions that might arise from members between now and the tea break. Immediately after tea break, then we get on to those different programs, which I think they will be dealing with your non-financial performance.
That's correct.
But I remember there you have quite an extensive presentation, which began to unpack issues that are contained in the annual report, as well as issues that were raised by the Auditor General last week when we engaged with them. And now, if you still have areas that are unclear or areas that you would want to engage on this presentation, please let's do so. I note your hand, Honorable Moran. Please take the platform, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want clarity on the invoice itself. It's not by that on the year end. This reoccurred this year again. I understand that the department are by rent to the Department of Public Works for buildings, or that by due payments for leased assets, could be motor vehicles or what the car should be. That is normal payments that occur every month, and the invoices comes in every month. What is so strange that these invoices is not paid on time? It could be only an annual invoice that is normally out of line that comes in around about year end that is maybe misplaced, or there could be a problem with it. The other payment should be a monthly payment. So either control is not in place, or the specific person in the department is not in control of his work doing that payment. Can you get clarity on that issue, please?
Thank you very much, Honorable Zondo.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I must thank the acting and outgoing for this difficult presentation, I must say. Difficult in the sense that the presentation is made post parting ways with another section, which makes our question better. Which makes the questioning, therefore, a bit difficult. I was interested in one slide where the acting DG was saying they have discovered that some of the assets that they recorded as having been lost were lying somewhere. In one department, which gives an impression that they might think that they have lost some goods, yet they are lying somewhere. Very difficult. But I want to let on what Honorable Member Mare was asking. On the observation of some of these invoices that are not paid in time, DG, you were saying you have looked at centralizing invoicing arrangement. I'm interested in that. How are you going to do that, and how will it talk to the problem?
And also, you were saying that some service providers, which is a delaying, that has got a delaying effect. Some service providers would cheat in billing. They would not bill appropriately. How often do you find that problem happening in the department? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kololo.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also thank the acting DG and the outgoing DG for the presentation. I've got two quick questions for clarity, Chair. The other one has been dealt with already by the previous speakers on the invoice is not paid on time. The other two would be on the theft and losses. That would be the first one. I just wanted to check if there is any remedial action taken on this one. And who are those people that were involved in that? If we could provide more information on that. And the second one would be on the transfer payment. I don't know, I think it's my ignorance there. I just want to see clarity around the question of the... I see they give IDC... they gave IDC an amount of 23 million rand for this small-scale mining. I just want to check if... are they supposed to give IDC money for training of small-scale miners? Are they supposed to contribute something to the IDC for that purpose? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Would you care to respond to those for now?
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. I must also start by thanking the members for the support that they have given us in terms of the handling this difficult period where we have just come out of being two departments and now we are focusing on being a newly established DMR, with a refocused mandate. However, all those things that we had to do in the past had to still continue, but mainly the whole process of handling the split and the reporting period, which we had to handle single-handedly as the DMR. Just coming into the specific questions from Honorable Mare, the question around invoices not paid at year-end and the reference to these being monthly payments. I must indicate, Honorable Chair, that the type of services that we get as a DMR, our key monthly invoices would relate to services from other state agencies like SITA, for telecommunications like Vodacom, Telcom, and therefore these ones are up to date. Where there are challenges is in relation to either project-driven invoices, and I will also now touch on to the question that was raised by Honorable Sond to say, how does the issue of service providers impact on our ability to finalize the payment within 30 days? With the current process, what happens when we either go out on tender or we send out a request for quotation? Service providers respond, we accept the proposal after it's been approved through our internal processes. When the work is done, they would then be an agreement in the contract that indicates how the billing would be done. It would either say you will bill on the basis of deliverables or you will bill on a monthly basis at this rate. Where we normally find problems where you have a billing based on deliverables, because as the invoices get delivered, the supply chain management unit, which is the central location for all invoices, will take those invoices, send them to the manager who manages that particular project to say, here is an invoice for $2 million from service provider ABC. Can you certify that they have performed work that is equivalent to the $2 million? And that's where the problem comes in, where either the figure that is put there, the manager is not happy with, or it's not a reflection of the work that has been done. Now, in terms of quantifying how many of these cases we have, this is something that we could go back and just analyze in terms of those invoices that were not paid on time, and perhaps come back with a report to say, these are the invoices. And I would immediately then move on to the next question around the centralization system, how will it assist in terms of us being able to pay invoices on time. In the past, we used to have a system where once approval is granted for the work to be done, the service provider would simply submit an invoice to the project manager. And in some instances, the human factor would kick in, the invoice gets to be put in the drawer and it's forgotten for 2 months until the service provider starts complaining. That's when you realize that there is this invoice that has not been paid. So we said, let's then find a system that would help us pick up all these invoices, even if the manager is not even there anymore. Because the other risk with the previous system was that you would have someone resigning during the project, and then they leave, that those invoices are in their office. Now there's an issue of how do we locate those particular invoices. So we then communicated to all our service providers that once you have done work, you need to ensure that your invoice is submitted to the supply chain management unit, where we then have a register. We log all these invoices as we receive them. We log even the date of receipt and the date that is on the invoice. Then we are in a position to track that. So at the end, look at how long has it taken us to process that invoice. So that's where the centralization assist a great. So what we are now proposing going forward is that as the work gets done, we shouldn't have the service provider sending the invoice this side and that invoice having to go to the manager for certification. There must be, as part of the project management meeting, there must be a specific format in which the sign-off on the work done happens before the billing. So the manager would sign off to say, yes, I'm happy that you have delivered the service and it's worth so much, as part of the reporting in the steering committee. So when they submit the invoice, it's already bearing the signature of the project manager. It takes us about 5 days to actually pay, because once that certification is done, within our systems, we are able to log it in, record it, get it into the financial system and pay it within a matter of a few days. So that is how we're proposing to resolve this thing going forward. On the issue around theft and losses, Honorable Hululu, remedial action, we have a combination. There are losses that can be attributed to specific individuals. As I indicated in our breakdown, there are those where it was a duplication, we've had to just correct that. So in that case, there is no remedial action. There are losses that we incurred as part of the relocation process. Again, in such a case, it becomes a bit difficult to say you are responsible, because this was a process that was coordinated by a number of people. So it becomes a little bit of a challenge to put responsibility on a particular individual. But having said that, we wanted to just satisfy ourselves that there was no deliberate wrongdoing on the part of officials. So we've re-looked at the type of losses that are there to see could we have prevented this, should somebody have acted differently. And the recommendation that has come to me as the acting DG was that the systems that were put in place were robust enough to prevent, you know, when you look at the bigger scale of things in terms of what we relocated and what was lost, we know of instances where some organizations, when they move, everything just gets left in the old building and they don't care what happens to that. So when you compare the loss figure to what is there, and also the element of these other assets that were found in the other department, the recommendation was that we should not consider taking any disciplinary measures against officials. On transfer payments, the 23 million to IDC, this is a program that when it started, we were giving technical support to small-scale miners. If you recall the old problem that we used to have, which might even still be there in some areas of illegal mining, this was part of our solution to address that problem, to say instead of just calling for illegal miners to stop mining, let's find a way that we can legalize them, help them with the technicalities of the licensing process, in terms of giving them support on some of the technical reports that have to be done. So this money we transfer to IDC as part of that. However, there has been some shortcomings in terms of the implementation, and that is why we are now rethinking the whole approach and the new strategy that we are busy finalizing. So it's not a subsidy to the IDC. It's money that is intended for small-scale mining.
Chairperson, it's not a follow-up. It's a brand new question.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chair. It's a very interesting information that I'm getting now. You know, I come from a small town in Mpumalanga called Barbato. So there's a lot of illegal mining that was taking place there. I think it would be proper for the department to at least transfer this information to the people around that area to say that no, you cannot go inside these mine shafts illegally. We'll train you and then you can go inside legally. I think that information would be very important for such towns like mine. Thank you very much. There's a comment.
Just on this issue of the IDC, exactly what is the IDC expected to do? Are they expected to develop the small-scale mining strategy, which you said you are busy handling yourself as DMR, or what exactly are they expected to do? Are they expected to provide some funding to the small-scale miners in some form of a seed capital, maybe? So just so that you understand, because IDC is quite a substantial formation with quite a serious capacity when it comes to financial muscle. Now, to again throw some money into them, you know, raises a flag.
The follow-up question on the communication of information, we take that on board. Once we have finalized the strategy, we would include a communication approach in terms of how we then make that information known in terms of what support can be given, how. On the role of the IDC, when in terms of how the program used to work, which is what we are reviewing currently. We used to have a combination of technical support as well as some element of financial support in projects related to beneficiation. So this would come in a form of a loan where, you know, the applicant, having fulfilled the requirement, would gone, having gone through the department, in other words, they would apply in the department. There was a board that would sit and adjudicate on those applications. Once a decision had been taken, then a letter would be returned to the IDC to say you can release so much to this particular applicant. So the IDC came in terms of them already having existing systems for managing such transactions. There has already obviously been a rethink in terms of our approach to that, because it has created a lot of unintended consequences. But particularly the point around us not being a financial institution as a department. So we feel that we need to rework that program and come up with well-packaged type of an approach. There is a thinking internally that we will share with the committee once the minister has approved the strategy. So that is the context in which IDC was brought on board. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Honorable Sondo, Honorable Bigani.
Thank you, Chair. I want to draw the department's attention to slide 55. Slide 35 says that you are out of what you don't have. You are outsourcing rehabilitation to Mintec. I might not be reading this correctly. Does that mean within the department is there no skill to undertake that responsibility? That is the first one. The second one, would come from slide 31, slide 30, slide 29 to slide 28. Now, slide 31 says that the BRRR recommendation seeks to task the department with the responsibility of capacitating itself so that there should be compliance. But I get disappointed when I go back to slide 28, that when the department is requesting a financial master, financial allocation from Treasury, out of a requested amount of 281, Treasury would just allocate 10. It's quite absurd, one would say. Now, we are saying that this department should play its role in terms of the key priorities that are identified in our quest to build the nation, to build our economy and all that. Now, is there any explanation by Treasury given when
you request 452 million, they would give you a mere 10 million. Is there any explanation given? And if there is an explanation given, one would be interested to understand what does it say. And if not, what skills flight do you experience out of this exercise? Where on one hand, we are saying this department should be capacitated. On the other hand, we are saying this department should not get money from Treasury. I'm just interested, Comrade Chairperson, as to what are we trying to do? What are we trying to do? I'm putting myself in the shoes of the department where they want to play their role, and they would identify key performance areas and cost those key performance areas, and they end up not being given what they request. Can you just clarify the committee, and so that we may understand what is at play between yourselves and Treasure? Because I don't suppose that when we're talking to Treasury, we're talking to Britain. We're talking to the very same cabinet where this department is represented. I am very, very worried what I'm going to hear from the program if the funding allocation is as that. What are we going to expect? What operations are we going to expect from the programs that are going to be presenting after this? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Dilani.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is a concern around the negative implications of your financial reports in relation to your relationship to energy. To just give an indication, if there is still future expected complications that you should expect, because I think some of the negative reports that you've had from the Auditor General are actually possibly related to your losses due to the fact that you had a split with DME. Now, what are the consequences going forward? That's towards the 2011-12 budget. Then the other question that I have, Chair, is I wish there could be more detailed explanation in relation to the 51M that was collected for royalties. Do you have any plan in place in terms of a detailed plan or perhaps a model in place in terms of what do you intend doing with these royalties that could give relief, immediate relief, especially to relevant communities? And just a general plan out of the Royalties Act, what do you intend doing with this money? I think if the money is there, it can't just be seated indefinitely. What are you saying? And what are the time frames related to that? Then in relation to the issue of IDC, Chair, I think in addition, without me repeating myself, it's to just get an indication of what time frames should we expect in terms of the third strategic plan that you say is being developed, or that you're waiting for approval for from Cabinet. When can we more or less expect something out of that? And does that include a special monitoring process to IDC? Does the strategic plan have that in place? How do you intend monitoring processes going forward? That's all, Chairperson. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I think let's give you all the questions so that you respond finally on this so that we can move on. One is on slide 13, where there are some funds, both the voted funds to be surrendered at 1.1 million and the revenue to be surrendered at 2.4 million. Now, when you have this kind of a situation and you pleading for more funding from National Treasury, is this not going to create a difficulty in you convincing National Treasury that you need more funding, given the fact that there's money that goes back to them at the end of the year? Now, that's one area. And I think the issue of the royalties have already been asked, because that's one question I had as well to find out. Now, on slide 18, which deals with the findings of the Auditor General, on your very point, which deals with the receivables, you did explain the reasons and the challenges that you are faced with in terms of the 72.2 million. But you have an action plan that you developed for the 2009-2010 audit findings, and now you're saying that this is being implemented as time goes on, but you are not giving us time frames in terms of at what stage would you be introducing the revenue management model linked to SAMRAT. Are you envisaging that within this year? Are you looking at that in the coming year, so that we know that this problem is handled and finalized once and for all? The other matter would relate to your irregular expenditure. Fortunately, this time around, according to the Auditor General, you have no irregular expenditure that is reported on, and that you are confirming it on slide 20 of your input. And but you basically have acted upon the 2009 and 10 financial report, and you're keeping a regular check in terms of your monthly updating of the register of the irregular expenditure, which is quite encouraging to notice. On this matter of the contingent liability, I know that at one stage when you came to present to us on the strategy to rehabilitate the ownerless and derelict mines, you've given us a figure of plus minus 6,000 sites that you are to work on, and there was a ballpark figure in terms of financials of something like 30 billion rand at that stage. Even then, it was not a final financial position that you were explaining to us. Back then, we've asked you whether there are no possibilities of tracing some of the owners of those derelict mines. The indication was that you would enter into that process of verifying. Out of the 6,000 sites, there might be those that can still be traced. Either they are now operating in different names from that they were operating at the time of them operating these mines, or they still own some of these, for instance, mine dumps, which are unrehabilitated. So we just want to know how far is that, because we might think that we have got a serious financial obligation. Meanwhile, there are some of the mining companies that are still in existence that should be called to account and, in fact, come to the party and pay for this. On slide 23, on the material losses, which are also reported in the Auditor General's report, I'm just interested in the time period of these figures. For instance, on your point 2, on assets that went missing, you are reporting that their purchase value was 3.3 million and their book value is 489,000. Quite a drastic you know, decrease. Does this mean that these are assets which you had them at the time you were DME, at the establishment of DME throughout, or are these the assets that were purchased immediately just before the split between minerals and energy, so that we can understand at face value, if you say you have had assets that were purchased at $3.3 million, one might say within this financial year you've lost quite a substantial amount of money, unless further explain that from where would you start counting in terms of the assets that you've had. I'm trying to be faster. Well, I think on the issue of funding, on slide 27 and slide 28, apart from the question that I've raised, I think, honorable members, it would be important for us to consider inviting National Treasury so that we understand exactly what are the basis of their decisions when they make allocations. We've raised this matter when we were handling the budget vote debate, and we've raised the fact that the amount allocated to DMR is insufficient. To further underpin this point, this morning, I think it was from 8 o'clock until around 9, the Chamber of Mines in the person of Mr. Begis Mia and the Minister of Mineral Resources, Honorable Shamangu, were on radio, and the discussion was so intense, the public was making serious calls, and indeed the issue there was quite clear that the matter of capacity of DMR came into light, and the minister made a public commitment that you now have a compliance unit which will then go out with, in fact, she raised it as an issue that is already happening. Meanwhile, here you are suffering in terms of funds that are earmarked to basically capacitate you so that you can be in a position to deal with the challenges that are facing the department. And this matter is very important, so that we get National Treasury here. The issue being that this is a sector that for the foreseeable future will remain in the public domain, and that the questions that were asked by that journalist, I would wish that I could hire him as my researcher, because he was like spinning figures, you know, like somebody who's reading, you know, a novel, because he was even able to break down the figures to provincial level. If you discuss Northern Cape, he would raise questions pertaining to Northern Cape, raising the issue of the benefit that is supposed to accrue to the communities, the benefits that are supposed to accrue to the country as a whole, which are currently accruing only to few individuals, being these conglomerates in the main, and as well as few individuals that come through, you know, BEE. And indeed, restating the fact that transformation is not taking place as it is supposed to be happening. So the minister was pushed towards the wall. One caller said, what we see, what we're listening to here are the buddy buddies. The department and the ministry and the Chamber of Mines are one and the same, because they've got the same views, they see things the same. That is in the public. And therefore, for us to then disprove that is for us to begin to go out there and be seen to be very basically checking. I think the minister has done a sterling work, because he tried to show that in terms of the moratorium that was there, you had picked up certain companies that were not compliant, and that there are notices that have been issued, and so forth. But it's basically to defend yourself on perceptions that are out there that are basically doing that. So I'm saying we need National Treasury so that we can begin to discuss seriously the matter of capacity within DMR. And I think now you provided us basis for that. Because if you ask 400 plus million and you are just given a mere 10 million, seriously, it's a cause for concern that we would need to be looking at. And the speed on the drafting of the strategy for the small scale miners has to be picked up. It has to be picked up in the sense that here you are talking of people who are intended to benefit in terms of the transformation process in the industry. If up until now we do not have the strategy, as you are indicating on slide 30, we have still have challenges. Now, I think we've also discussed this matter on the PRRR. It will come again in this year's PRRR, the whole question of capacity. Because it can't be that every time we're making reference, because you won't also see whether you are making progress yourself until the capacity has been built. Now, lastly, DG, the Auditor General, apart from the issues that you have been able to deal with on receivables and the revenue, indeed raised the matter on point 10 in page 111 of the 53.5 million rand payables, which I think speaks to the issue of the royalties, and it would be interesting to hear what exactly is the final position, because if this, you know, recurs year after year in, year out, then it is soon going to present us with a problem. Now, point 11 of the Auditor General's report makes reference to 36.3 million rand of the receivables for departmental revenue debt balances that are outstanding for longer than 3 years. And I don't know if in terms of your remedial actions that you have reported is taking care of this matter. You dealt with the material losses of the 5.8 million rand. On page 112.18, where the Auditor General is reporting on additional matters, particularly on point 19, the supplementary information that he believes that he had difficulty in auditing that supplementary information. I don't know what are the reasons, because they are not discussed thoroughly on the documents before us. And 23.24.25.26.27 refers to the breach of the provisions of the PFMA. In your input, you did not make reference in terms of how are you going to be able to deal with that going forward. What also worries me is on page 99, because it the structure that you have set up that is intended to assist you to deal with matters of auditing, the audit committee. I take it that this is an internal audit committee that you have put in place. But looking at this structure, you have, the chairperson who is consistent in terms of the attendance of the meetings. The second person, Ms. Haynes, has never attended not a single meeting. You are explaining there that it's due to ill health. But indeed, what were the reasons for her not to be replaced? If it is discovered that her ill health condition is to an extent that she would not be able to perform her functions as necessary. Then Mr. Van der Nest has also done well, and the last person, Musa Mirapamwe, because of his late appointment, he attended only one meeting. That is understandable. Now, this structure is a structure that we would expect that they must be in a position to pick up these shortcomings before the Auditor General comes through. And I'm not sure in terms of the frequency of the meetings whether this takes into account the whole year. They meet only four times, which means they meet once per quarter. Is that frequent enough in order for them to can be able to be of an assistance to you as a department, or would you need to increase the frequency of that meeting? And I'm not sure whether the department sits in the structure and who in the department is the CFO sitting here, or is it just purely people that are appointed from outside? Please take us through those so that we can then move on to the other matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Sorry, there's one question. Yes, no, sir.
Slide 36 or page 36, last paragraph, out of header contributing factor vacancy is a result of the department's inability to attract professionals and the time frame associated with field goals. What are these specific goals, and what is the TMR doing in this regard as they are? The report in this regard. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Give the report.
I will deal with some of the questions and my colleagues will then come in and fill in on those that I may have left out. In terms of questions from Honorable Sont on the outsourcing to MINTEC, whether there are no skills internally, the answer would be yes. We don't have the type of skills that would be required in terms of managing the entire program. And I think the colleague from MINTEC can manage. Yeah, maybe that. Just elaborate in terms of the role that MINTEC plays so that you can put it in the right context.
With your permission, gladly, sir. Good morning, honorable members, once again. The value proposition that MINTEC brought to the Department of Mineral Resources was that we provided a one-stop shop. We provide the whole variety of services in-house, from engineering and designing the rehabilitation projects to their execution and the project management thereof, including advertising for tenders and those sorts of things, that makes it much quicker to do the process through MINTEC than through the Department of Mineral Resources. At the time when we initiated the program also, I know that there were particular challenges with some of the skills perhaps not being readily available within the department. And MINTEC was happy to step into and assist the department in that regard.
Then the next question on the funding request versus the subsequent allocation. I think this is, we are quite happy, Chair, with the resolution of the committee to then invite colleagues from Treasury so that there could be some form of engagement with the committee on how the process works and some of the reasons why the funding requests from the department don't receive the sort of response that would be ideal. We do engage with Treasury, and I think the issue that normally gets raised is the whole issue around the environment in which we're operating in terms of the economic situation, that we are
working in an environment where we are trying to reduce the expenditure as a percentage of our GDP, and also the whole issue around reducing the budget deficit. So that in itself then puts pressure on the treasury in terms of how much can be made available for allocation. But I think we'll leave that to that engagement with the national treasury, so that some of these reasons that do not always come up could then be discussed in that engagement. In relation to the impact on the on the skills and what sort of impact this has on our work, we obviously, you know, the case in point would be the compliance inspection unit within mineral regulation, where we would just want to clearly indicate that the unit, in terms of the structure, is there. There is a structure that is approved, but we are unable to fill in with the warm bodies because of the funding challenges. So what we've been doing has been a combination of trying to, you know, do with the little resources that we have, where we take some of the people who are involved in adjudication processes and use them to do compliance inspections, which is not an ideal process, as I indicated earlier on, that it then begins to impact on our ability to finalize and process applications on time. So the ideal situation would be for that entire structure, or at least part of it, to be fully funded so that we can begin to make the impact that we should be making. And I think Joel would add a few more comments on that at a later stage. Questions from Honorable Pikane on the impact of the split and any future complications that might arise out of this process. The response to this would be, yes, there would be areas where there would still be issues on our report that relate to the marriage we used to have with the Department of Energy. As I indicated in the presentation, there are some services that we continue to render on behalf of the Department of Energy and recover the cost associated with that from them, as highlighted in one of the slides. So we might be getting into those situations where perhaps if there are delays in terms of the recovery of that money, it might, depending on how much is there, we might find the Auditor General saying that there are issues with the recoverability of the money, although we are one government and that should not be an issue. But when one just looks at it from an accounting point of view, that might create a debate around that. On the royalties, plan on utilizing the royalties collected. I must indicate that there are two types of royalties. There are those royalties that were collected in terms of the old Minerals Act, which ceased to exist, or rather came to an end in February of 2010, when the new Royalty Act kicked in on the 1st of March 2010. Those were then phased out. And then the new royalties that are collected now by SARS in terms of the Royalty Act. In as far as the first one is concerned, we had a combination of two arrangements. There were those that were paid directly into DMR, and some where DMR had ceded the right to collect to communities, where you would then have the mining company paying directly to the community where, you know, the mining is taking place. All of that has now stopped to it's no longer applicable. So even the money that we are sitting with now and that which we have been collecting, it all had to be paid over into the revenue fund. The understanding being that, you know, mining is a national patrimony, and therefore we cannot have a situation where the collection of this type of revenue then only benefits a particular section of the community instead of the nation as a whole. So even with the new Royalties Act, all the money is collected in terms of that go into the National Revenue Fund and get allocated on the same basis as any other taxes that is collected. So there is no special dispensation for the utilization of royalties as such. The next question on the IGC and the small-scale mining strategy, we are targeting the end of December, Chair, for this strategy to be approved finalized. As I indicated, there is already a draft which has been presented to myself. So once the changes that I've asked for are done, we can then go and table it to the minister for final approval. The question from the chair on the whether would it be in our advantage to go and ask for funding when we are showing an understanding. I think, Chair, it's always difficult to measure the level of spending mid-term when the year is not yet finished, because you are basing it on a comparison of projections that take certain assumptions into account. You know, we look at the history, we have got some plans in terms of how certain things should happen and when they should happen. So in the event that any of those assumptions change, you then have a situation where there is a discrepancy between your projection and your extra. And this is part of the reason why on a monthly basis we submit this Section 32 to Treasury to indicate in terms of what we have projected, this is how much we have spent, these are the reasons why we haven't spent what we ought to have spent, and these are the interventions in terms of bringing the projections back to line with the actual. So they give us an opportunity to even reproject, you know, as we go through the year. So the correct measure would then be to look at the figure that we're sitting with at year end to say, have you spent the money that you were allocated on the things that you were supposed to spend it on? And then that if you then look at it from that perspective, I think the year that we are reporting on is quite clear on that we have even gone beyond just spending what we have. If you then introduce the technicality around Aqua, if we were a company, we would actually be reporting a loss. And then in terms of we appreciate the comments on irregular expenditure, although that there are some items that we have reported in there, even by AG's own admission, those were not significant items that warranted them to even put them in the report. So our processes have really yielded some results in terms of that. So we appreciate that from the chair. Contingent liability, process of tracing the owner. I think, Chair, here I would allow my colleague from CGS just to briefly take the committee through what the work that they are going to be doing in terms of taking the process from the database to a point where we are able to say these are the priority sites, this is what we need to be rehabilitating over this period of time. But let me just finish the other questions, we will come back to that. The time effect on the assets that we are indicating as having lost some value, it's a combination. You would see from our report, there is a part where we talk about the lifespan of different categories of assets. For example, your computer would have a lifespan of 3 years. Furniture would have a lifespan of about 7 years. So what we did there to arrive at the book value, we looked at the types of items, we then projected the book value on the basis of the lifespan that is that they are supposed to be with us for. So you would have those assets that were bought during the time where DME, and I think we can confidently say all these losses that are reported here relate to items that were bought when we were still DME, because the DMR assets were only brought into account in the 2010-11 financial year. So these were losses that were relating to old assets. In terms of the payables, the question on what is the position going forward? We have been engaging with SARS, and I think we are now at a point where we have agreed on what needs to be done with that money. As I indicated, everything that we collected ought to end up in the National Revenue Fund. So that collection would have to just be deposited as like any other form of revenue into the National Revenue Fund. The only issue is around the accounting treatment in terms of saying how do you record it? Do you record it as royalties or do you record it as miscellaneous income? And those are some of the engagements that we still need to do going forward. The provision for doubtful debts, this is largely linked to the binding on receivables, where they're basically saying the standards require us to make a provision in the event that there is an amount owing to us that it has been outstanding for longer than 3 years. We need to provide for a potential loss, to say in the event that this person doesn't pay, this is what we are likely to recover. So what the AG is saying is that if your calculations on the receivables have not assisted me to come to a conclusion that it is the correct amount, it means even in terms of your provision, that error will flow through, which is the point that I was making in the introduction earlier on, to all the other items such as the provision for doubtful debt. And then the root causes that the AG laments on around the accounting officers not having done certain things in terms of the PFMA. I think the approach has been to report root causes at the level of, say, you know, this is what the PFMA says. Like the PFMA would broadly say the accounting officer must implement an effective, efficient financial and risk management system. So if there is an error or a finding that relates to any of these three, they would simply put a conclusion that says the accounting officer has not implemented such a system. So it would be a bit strong and harsh, Chair, to say that there has been a breach of the PFMA. We understand that it eventually links up to that, but the system would have been there. It was implemented. However, because of the shortcomings that were there, one can then conclude that particular requirement in the PFMA has not been met. And I think that's why even the way in which it's reported, they don't report on it as a compliance, non-compliance issue. It's reported as an error on the financials themselves. On the issue of the audit committee, I think our chief audit executive can talk to that. So if you can do that, and then we get Herman Hank to talk to
him. Thanks, Chair. On the issue of the audit committee, we start with the frequency of the meetings that the audit committee had.
Press your sheet.
Is pressed. Maybe I'm too far from it. Okay, I'll start with what the PFMA dictates in terms of the frequency of the meetings. The PFMA dictates that the audit committee should have at least 2 meetings in a year. But however, as a department, we've looked at that and we felt that it would not be sufficient. Hence, you see at the beginning of the audit committee report that it indicates that the audit committee charter dictates that they should have at least 4 meetings a year. And if you look at how it's always been in the prior years, financial year 7, 8, 9, and even 9, 10, when we're still the DME, with the same members, the top three, we always had 6 meetings. However, last year we had a bit of challenges because then we were closing DME, and then DOE was also trying to capacitate its own. So we had a bit of challenges in terms of aligning the diaries of the two committees now to make sure that we close DME and then we start with DMR. But otherwise, we've always had 6 meetings, and as it is now, this year, by the end of this month, we shall have had 4 meetings already. So we are back to normality now. We're going to be having normal meetings as we always had previously. The next question is, why did we not replace Ms. Hain? Chair, I should say that Ms. Hain had been with the then DME for several years, and she had served the department selflessly. She had added a whole lot of value. There are a whole number of things that she did for the department in terms of even going as far as evaluating the effectiveness of the internal audit unit, and it had been for a number of years. And as a department, we had hoped that she was going to get better. But then over and above that, the other issue is that when we are reappointed last year, we considered then, because of this same issue, that we should add one person. Hence, you see the appointment of the fourth member there. She was a new member. These three are the ones that served the DME previously. So last year, because of this problem, we decided to add a fourth person. But over and above that, the arrangement with her was that she would still prepare. Not that she was only going to receive the PECs, but she would receive PECs, prepare, and submit her comments to other members so that when we engage in the audit committee, then her comments are also factored in. The third one, Chair, is about who sits in the audit committee. Is it only these members that we have here? The answer is, as to the requirements of the TFMA, we do have these three, which obviously meet the requirement, but over and above that, we've got people who receive standing invitations into the audit committee. Among those is the DG, so the DG sits there. The CFO receives a standing invitation. The Chief Audit Executive receives a standing invitation. Also, the Chief Compliance Officer who also receives a standing invitation to the audit committee meetings. But over and above that, we have heads of components who also get invited to attend these meetings. But we also have the Auditor General who also receives a standing invitation in the audit committee meetings. And lastly, the National Treasury. They are also part of the audit committee meetings. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, honourable members, maybe to look through what has been done up to now, looking at derelict and ownerless mines, and what is now in the current proposal, which is being discussed and which will be started in the near future. I think maybe start off with the 30 billion rand figure. That was a calculation based on generic cost assumptions on the sites in the database. So we were able to say that this sort of site should cost this sort of amount to rehabilitate. Now, if we look at that, at the time it was done, it was probably the best estimate we could come up with. I think the ways we're looking at improving on that estimate, the first thing is removing sites from the database. So sites which are either have been rehabilitated, are identified to have an owner who is legally liable for the rehabilitation and financially capable of doing that rehabilitation. Sites where new rights have been issued. And then the identification of sites, and there are quite a number, where minimal or no rehabilitation is required. There are also quite a number of sites where the
the estimates we came up with would be an overestimate because the real impact in the field, an example would be sites which were mined a very long time ago where, you know, natural processes have really attenuated a lot of those impacts. And in cases like that, we would be able to say that the actual impact is lower, or is lower or minimal and can be removed from that database or from that cost calculation. I think to bear in mind that there are going to be some sites where there are profound environmental and health and safety impacts which have to be addressed. If we look at the total scope of the work that has been done, what we were initially asked to do between 2005 and 2008 was to develop the database, which we've done based on the identification of mineral deposits which have been mined, are no longer mined, and are in an abandoned state. At the time, it's actually very difficult. It's possible to go through records and look at sites which are currently within, it's mainly in the Mineral Bureau's records, and see who the owners are. But there are many, many more sites in that database than are held by the Mineral Bureau. To develop a ranking system for these sites, and then to implement the ranking system. By 2008, the project was originally scheduled to run until 2010. By 2008, we'd run a pilot run of the ranking system on a list of 85 sites. Now, what's important is that those 85 sites go from sites with a very, very high environmental impact to sites with virtually no environmental impact. So it's not a list of priority sites that we tried to, in fact, get as much of a spread between different commodities and different sizes of mines, to really get a feel for what the impact of different kinds of mines would be. What we've done now in discussion with the department, we've realized that system, while it has value, that there are some enhancements that we need to do to it, which we're currently looking at. One of these things, and I think maybe look at the issue of tracing owners. What we've always felt is that the best time to start tracing the owner is at the point when a site looks like it will need state intervention. To go through a list of 6,000 sites, I think the earliest site in our database was mined. I've visited the site myself. It has a very small impact, but it was mined it was actually created and mined during a couple of weeks in 1672. And it's the Van der Stel copper mine in the Namaqualand, where there was a trial mine and a decision that it wasn't worth mining because there wasn't water. So what we're looking at, in a case like that, there's no point in going and tracing owners of sites which will need no rehabilitation. So the ownership tracing really comes in when a high-priority site is identified. I think what also becomes important is that between the identification of priority sites and the launch of a rehabilitation program, you'll sometimes have new applicants taking up those rights, in which case the rehabilitation would become the responsibility, or at least in part the responsibility, of that new applicant. I think what we're looking at is a more comprehensive site investigation to actually start to generate a conceptual rehabilitation plan and identify rehabilitation requirements. So really feeding into the work that MinTech is doing on rehabilitation. Integration of the CGS and DMR databases, but the two databases have existed apart and we need to actually start to integrate them far better. I'm just having a look here, starting to quantify not just the impact of the site, but the size and impact of its environmental footprint. I think with some of the larger, particularly coal and gold mines, we see impacts a long distance downstream, and those have to be taken into account as well. And then really trying to build more interaction with other projects. So we have a number of projects running looking at mining impacts and how to deal with them. And it's ready to integrate with us so that we get the best value for money out of this project. Thank you.
Maybe the last question from Honorable Mjali on the vacancies that are referred to on this slide. We'll take that as part of the corporate services presentation.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, I think let's take strictly a 5-minute body break. Grab some tea, is there still there? And then grab tea, come back, so that we can then listen to the remaining presentations. Even when we come back, we will talk of
strict time frames because we've got very short time remaining. We will give each presenter 5 minutes to talk to the presentation. That means you will talk to us. We will time you because we also want your time to engage with your presentation. So let's hand over to your team, DJ.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Honorable members, I would like to present the non-financial performance information for Program 1 under Sub-Program 1-1, Chief Financial Office. The outlines of this presentation will be talking to the successes within the program, the challenges accompanied by the corrective measures to address those challenges. This should be read in conjunction with pages 40 to 59 of the annual report. The purpose of the sub-program is to provide strategic and administrative support services to the ministry as well as the department. The approach used is a balanced scorecard, which has got four perspectives made out of customer perspective, internal processes, learning and growth, and financial perspective. The first success or achievement under the customer perspective that the branch has realized is the driving of transformation policies, wherein we have achieved 97% on the employment equity, which was targeted at 90%. The second one on driving transformation of policies is that we have managed to register the historically disadvantaged South African, or HDSA, suppliers or potential service provider in our database by 12% against the target of 10%. Under the internal process perspective, the following achievements or successes have been realized. The first one is under develop and review internal processes, where the target was to have identified five internal processes, review them and implement. There we have, instead of the five that were suggested, reviewed as 13 of them and implemented both of them, exceeding the target by 8. We have also managed to implement the policies and guidelines, 4 policies and 4 procedures that were set to have been achieved in that period. We also managed to review 12 policies against the target of 10. Continuing on the next slide, on the internal processes perspective, on driving the innovation, we have improved certain processes. We have also realized the 17% cost saving against the target of 5% that was set. We have again effectively implemented the system by creating 3 awareness initiatives. Slide 7, continuing now with the learning and growth perspective. Under this perspective, we have improved the management and leadership capabilities by ensuring that the work plans of every employee and their management has been aligned to personal development. Personal development of management has been aligned to the management requirements. We have also promoted the core values, and we have held workshops to do that. Of the six that we have planned to do, we have managed to do 7 workshops to instill the values. And on the service delivery improvement initiative, we have had 6 deliver improvement initiatives that we have planned for implemented. The last perspective, which is financial perspective on page 8. Here, under the objective of aligning budget to strategy, we've ensured that the spending plans with, that are developed are aligned to budget. Those budgets are aligned to strategy. We have also managed the cost effectively by ensuring that the underspending remain within the threshold, which is the 0.11% that was reported earlier. And we have promoted the corporate governance by ensuring that all policies and policies that are HR related have been met. I'm now going to talk about the challenges that we have experienced, together with the corrective measures that we have put in place to ensure that those challenges are addressed. Under the internal processes, the customers one we fortunately have achieved all, so I'll only talk to those that like internal processes where we have had challenges. We have had challenges on adhering to the service level agreement, and here we are saying that the correct measure, the corrective measure will be to develop and implement the checklist and monitor performance on monthly basis. If I can just give a little background, the problem here was that we realized that as much as we want to do this, there was no monitoring tool to measure this. So in the corrective measure going forward will be to ensure that we develop the checklist that will help us to monitor that SLAs are adhered to. Adherence to prescribed turnaround time. Here we have a challenge in that some of the processes that we are responsible for were not identified and put together so that we can measure them. And as a result, we have realized or we have actually gone and reviewed the service catalog, which then helps to talk to every process that is happening within the CFO branch, and which each of those should have a measure which will enable us to adhere to the turnaround times that are set. Adherence to turnaround times on filling vacancies. This is one of the challenges. We are saying as a corrective measure we will place the advert within 2 weeks of the termination notification.
Your 5 minutes is up. But
okay. The availability of the system and increasing the number of ICT related complaints, we are going to establish the help desk to address those challenges. Okay, under learning and growth, I'll be quick. We couldn't, due to the constraints on finance, send all managers to courses, but for the 7 that we identified courses for, only 4 attended, and also the 360 degree assessment that was supposed to be done, we couldn't do that, and we have actually changed to look at a different measure altogether. Critical positions that were supposed to be vetted, only a few, all of those that we have handed over for vetting couldn't be vetted. And we can just monitor the branch responsible to do that, as they will be, they are busy doing that in the meantime. Finally, on the financial perspective, reduction in irregular and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. We have realized that due to what the acting DG has indicated, irregular expenditure that was not so material or not reported, the main challenge there was the interpretation and also the gap that was created when National Treasury updates something through the practice note or any other directive. We are now going to make sure that our policies talk to those changes every time when those changes take place. The execution of fraud and prevention strategy or implementation plan, we are going to update the implementation plan risk with risk for the 2010-2011 and execute them accordingly. Number of repeated findings on internal audit follow-up reports, we are, as usual, going to develop, implement, and monitor action plan to address those findings and ensure that we get to monitor how we are progressing towards those commitments that we make or have made to address those challenges. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. I would rather start with the vacancies.
Okay.
Okay, the vacancies. Okay. None of the other ones. Look at the vacancy presentation up there. I just want to take us back to in January when the president made the call. We were standing at a total. Let's look at the last column of the total. We were standing at 183, and by the end of June, we had about 120 of the 183 filled, which left us with about 63 that was not filled. Of that 63 that was not filled, 38 of that was from Mine Health and Safety. And the reason why we have highlighted the 28, you know, the asterisks against the 28, was what we had submitted up front to say we might not be able to achieve in the Mine Health and Safety branch, because of the challenges in that branch. And one of those challenges is the fact that we cannot attract the kind of inspectors, inspectors that we would want to attract. The reason for that, in addition to the Honourable Member's question that came up, the reason for that being that the Finance Resolution 3, where we cannot hire new employees at level 13 and level 10. Most of the people that we have wanted to employ would have a salary band, you know, from 11 to 13, and that has been the challenge that the department has been facing. And over and above that, even though we haven't managed to employ those people, we have a number that we actually poaching from us, those very people poaching from us, over even higher salaries. So, in that area, especially in mine health and safety, they continuously have those vacancies because of those dynamics that I've just explained. So the total funded posts for the establishment is 9,983. Third post is 9,041, which leaves us with vacant funded posts to date of 142, but I'm pleased to also mention that of that 132 posts in progress is 102. The achievement, I must add, is that we have achieved 87% of what we had set ourselves out to do at the beginning of the year, which leaves us with a 13%, and of that 13%, 9% now has been or is in progress, and we're hoping that will be that would be finalized, those vacancies would be finalized before the end of the year. And I have also added, as the DG has already alluded, to the fact that we pride ourselves in the fact that much as we have a 6 month period in which to fill our vacancies, we have an average period of 4 months in the department. If we then want to go to the next slide, if we want, you know, to see what the vacant and unfunded posts are of the department. Total posts, which, okay, total posts, funded and unfunded, let's look at the total column, would be 1,713. Of that field is alluded, as I've already alluded to the fact that the vacant and funded, we have an outstanding of 142, which leaves us of the funded posts, which leaves us with 530 of vacant and unfunded. We've explained before that according to the DPSA, we should not even consider vacant and unfunded because as far as they are concerned, vacant and unfunded does not exist. So the department has now been focusing on vacant and funded posts, and I've already explained the situation where we stand with those with the vacant and unfunded. I'll move off from vacancies. Because of time constraints, you have the presentation of the successes of the branch, corporate services branch. What I will hone in on would be the challenges of corporate services. Or maybe I can just go just brush over the what we've achieved. We've achieved to get bursaries for 17 Gen learners, which is a project that the minister started. And so far we've had 17 bursaries from the mining companies. But over and above that, we have had about 60 bursaries from the NQA, which will come directly to the department. And of those 60, for those 60, then the department has committed to bring those bursaries in as intense or to provide them with experiential training. We have managed to implement our communication initiatives. We've completed some of the projects benefiting vulnerable groups. We've assisted in that light. Mining career opportunity workshops, we've run those workshops. For instance, one of them, which has been Mamelodi career guidance workshop that we ran, the Learners Focus Week and the SOA career guidance workshops that we ran. The execution of DNR staff development programs. We are successfully running the EDP, which is a flagship of our development program with Vets University. We have students, I think, they completed the program in August, and we had to see then how, you know, whether all of them will graduate or not. We've had the strategy, communication strategy approved. We've had successful annual briefings. We've managed to place more opinion pieces. By that, we mean more initiated opinion pieces, not media initiated media pieces. Let's repeat them. The challenges we're facing, as we've already mentioned, we have lack of funding to capacitate the department for those vacant positions that we have identified. We will only be implementing the talent management strategy. In fact, we will seek approval of that in 2011. We've only had it developed and finalized in 2010. And those are the challenges, although now we continue basically with managing that strategy, which is mainly career development for our employees. Another challenge that we've had has been the time of processing of some presidential hotline queries. Not of our own meeting, it is mainly with some information that we would demand from people externally that we have come more on time for us to complete the queries, you know, on time. So we've had some challenges. Failure to conduct customer service satisfaction survey, this again is due to lack of funds. We have DCIS given us a quote of $2 million to run a thorough customer service satisfaction survey. We have not been able to receive those, to get those funds, to get a commitment from Treasury for those funds. The vacancy rate escalated in the last quarter, and the staff turnover rate could not be reduced considerably because of you know, various other things with people retiring and other, you know, deaths and you know, all those other things that are related to the staff movement. Corrective measures, we are preparing requests for regional financial entity as process for the implementation of the approved organization structure. We want the assistance we will get from the committee that that process can be approved. As I said earlier, talent management strategy will only be approved in May 2011. As I said, it doesn't stop us actually still from implementing some of the objectives in the strategy. The sign off, of course, by the relevant chief directors responsible for the regional offices. This is what I was referring to earlier about, you know, signing off of the presidential hotline. Consultation on the DCIS is going to be conducted in 2011-2012. That's what we said we would do. Unfortunately, we're not able to do that because we don't have funding for that. The first sector and the filling of vacancies. Again, you know, we're trying our best in fact-checking that process, but unfortunately, again, for the positions that we say are unfunded, we still have a challenge, but the ones that are funded, we are trying our best to fast-track the filling of those vacancies. And we would have a very close monitoring of the staff turnover rate. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next presentation will be on mine health and safety. I'll skip the first two slides and go directly to some of the achievements as well. In terms of the strategic objective, manage health and safety risk, as the DG has indicated, we have achieved a 24% reduction in fatalities. And I think we also come from an era where seismicity or rock burst has been the major cause of fatalities in the industry. But I'm glad to say that we have achieved a 60% reduction in rock burst related fatalities and 63% in terms of machinery for the reporting period. However, we are still concerned with the continued loss of life within the sector. In terms of inquiries, as indicated, we've achieved about 100% and investigations 96%, audit 79%. In terms of the next objective, development of guidelines, we've developed the enforcement and the administrative fines guidelines. This also has helped in terms of ensuring that there's a consistent and transparent approach across all the regions in enforcing the law, especially with the enforcement guidelines, we've seen a reduction in of appeals of infractions that have been issued. And we've also developed similarly the respective policies and procedures to support those guidelines, the enforcement or application of those guidelines. And lastly on that slide, in terms of the human resource development objective, we continuously train our inspectors, the current inspectors, to improve on the work that we do, mainly on inspections, audits, investigations, and we train them on enforcement and legal enforcement in terms of our act. So we've sent 83 inspectors through the best training course, and also 34 other officials attended other administrative and technical courses. The next slide, it shows the fatality and injury rates per million hours. The fatality rate is indicated in green, and the injury rate is indicated in red. Sorry about that. Then what is important is that between 2003 up to the end of 2010, we've seen a gradual decrease. But I think of concern for us is that within the first quarter of this year, we've seen a sudden increase in the fatality rate, and we believe that mainly because of the change in economical conditions, where we have seen a lot of mines, especially within the gold and platinum mines, they've suddenly increased production, and it has affected the current rate. And we are just following the commodity prices. The gold price was about $2,000, and we believe that they were really following on that. And some of the substantial incidences as well were occurred in the other mines, those mines that supply material for infrastructure and construction as well. And when we look at the profile of the causes of the accidents, we can see that it has to do with the push for production. But I think it's a similar trend was identified between 2008 and 2009, where we see changes in finance, in economic conditions. It also affects the injury fatality rates. But we constantly engage with the industry to be more vigilant on that. The next slide shows the death or the fatality rates comparing 2009 and 2010. As indicated, we had a 24% reduction in total fatalities, mainly with the coal sector of 28 and the other sectors of 29. The gold sectors and the platinum sectors similarly had 22% improvement. But I must highlight that the coal and the platinum sectors had the lowest fatality rate of 0.09%, as indicated on that slide. The next slide shows the fatality rates this year, comparing this year and last year for the same period. As you can clearly see that we have not really maintained the achievements that we had last year, and so it's of a great concern to us for the reasons that I've indicated of production and so forth. But with the coal sector, we can clearly see that there's been about 12% improvement. The next slide shows the operational diseases. For 2009 and 2010, the major cases that are being reported, as you can see for both years, silicosis, pulmonary TB, noise-induced hearing loss, pneumoconiosis, asbestosis, silico TB, and the other. I think what is very important to highlight is that the latency effect or period of these start diseases. It takes between 10 to 15 years to acquire silicosis. It takes about 6 years or more to acquire noise-induced hearing loss. It takes you about 20 years to acquire asbestosis. So these are the legacies of the past, really, that we are really dealing with. And with the pulmonary TB cases, the challenge is the living conditions as well. I'll elaborate on it. And also the issue of HIV and AIDS, as indicated before. That really we are grappling with. But I'll just indicate what we are doing to deal with that. Next slide, on the challenges on occupational health, as I've just alluded to. Most of the diseases are mainly reported by the gold and the platinum mines. But what we have done as a department, we have established a chief directorate on health, and we've appointed the chief director recently and two directors on occupational hygiene and occupational medicine to really to drive our strategy of improving health issues long term. I think one of we've been having, our industry has been in existence for almost a century now, but we are still having some mines or some mine employees living under poor living conditions in single sex hostels, especially with the gold and platinum mines. So our drive is to take out people out of the single sex hostels and improve their living conditions. And we believe that it will also impact on health and safety because, for instance, if you are suffering from TB and living with 4 or 10 people in one room, the other people might be also affected. The same thing with safety. If you are living in one room, then you don't share the same shift. There's issues of fatigue that you have to deal with, and we believe that they affect the safety trend as well. We are planning to have an HIV and TB summit by next month in November in conjunction with the Department of Labor and Department of Health as well, and the other stakeholders, to deal with the challenges that I've alluded to. And again, the issues of dust. We are greatly concerned with the dust results that we receive from the mine in terms of the accuracy. So we'll be working together with some state-owned entities to assist us with the verification of the dust results that are being reported to us to make sure that we improve on the quality and the monitoring of those. In terms of safety, although we have achieved some milestones, as I indicated previously, we are still concerned with the continued loss of life. We will continue with the hard stance that we have taken of stopping mines which are unsafe. We've issued about 511 instructions, Section 54 instructions, over 911 transgressions. And I think for us, we have, because of this, we've seen a change in attitude, especially from the top level, the CEOs and the boards, because they lose if we stop them. But it's not our intention to, for them to lose, but to make sure that there's an improvement on health and safety. And the change in attitude is resulting in them putting certain measures on improving health and safety. The next point there, we'll also be holding a mine health and safety summit this year to review the progress made since the last one and make sure that we take necessary steps moving forward to enhance health and safety. And again, we are also reviewing our Act. Previously, our Act has been outcome-based. In other words, it's risk-based. The employers can only take measures based on the risk assessment. But now we are saying we're going to put minimum standards with it to make sure that any other measures which are considered, they should include minimum standards. And lastly on that slide, we are requesting quarterly reports from the mining companies and boards and engaging the CEOs. I think it has helped as well, especially with the adoption of the leading practice. Some mines now, they are talking about putting in close proximity devices to prevent machinery-related or transport-related incidences, to implement safety nets to prevent fall of ground incidences as well. And one of the mining groups indicated that for the first time they established a position of executive manager on safety and health, and we believe it will also help us in improving safety and health in that particular group. In terms of capacity challenges...
5 minutes is long past.
Oh, sorry. Okay, I'm looking up. Sorry, Chair. In terms of capacity challenges, we have appointed 19 learner inspectors, and we have allocated mentors to help them to achieve their qualifications. 30% of our accidents happen in the Rustenburg area. We've split the Northwest office into two, and we've appointed a new PI to drive our strategy there. And we're also appointing legal advisors in the six big regions where the accidents are happening to help us with the inquiries and investigations. I spoke about the establishment of the Chief Director of Patient Health. And lastly, Chair, the certificate of competency, we're in a drive to improve the pass rates as well. We are greatly concerned with the low pass rate, which also affects transformation within the sector. So we are working together with the MTA to come up with a good model or a better model into the future to improve the people. We have also short-term drafted an action plan to improve the pass rate. So thank you. Sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. I will be taking Honorable Members through program number 3. And presenting the report, the presentation should be read together with pages 77 to 86 of the annual report. I would go straight, because of time, and highlight the key successes before flagging the challenges, which is on the slide on page number 5. To essentially indicate that because of the nature of the work that we do, which is the processing of applications, since 2004, we have realized in excess of 625 new mining rights that were issued, of which 435 already used for mining. Around SIP, we have exceeded the set target for the year under review for job creation, and as well as exceeding the target for the granting of rights to historically disadvantaged. Then the same target for women-led mining companies licensed has been exceeded, and the target for inspection to monitor and enforce compliance was also exceeded. And we took various actions to enforce compliance, and in some cases moved to revoke rights initiated. And this resulted from the drive that we embarked upon on conducting inspections. Because as honorable members would recall, the latter part of the year under review got covered by the period of moratorium that was in place. I need to also indicate, before moving over to slide on challenges, that our department, has been articulated over and over again, has shifted focus away from ordinarily doing licensing, towards compliance inspection. And to give effect to this, as a start, we needed to put in place or develop an organizational structure, also responding to the directives that we had received from Parliament around setting up a compliance inspection unit. And we did that, and in terms of the structure, we then have provided 414 personnel. But I need to indicate that one of the challenges, as there was outlined throughout the presentation, has been relating to lack of funding. Also indicating that the lesson that we had learned from the moratorium that we did was that if you do compliance inspection and enforcement, the levels of compliance by right holders improve. And the results that have been coming in bear testimony to that. Another challenge that I just need to highlight is that the drive on inspections diverted our resources ordinarily from processing applications and adhering strictly to prescribed time frames, because we need to use the same resources that ordinarily are used for adjudication. And in some cases, we had found that right holders had not exercised the rights that we issued to them, which continue to be a challenge for us as a department. We then had issued various Section 93, which deals with non-compliance, and Section 47, in terms of the MPRD, which deals with the intention to cancel the right. But in finalization of these various notices, diligence is required, because we don't want unnecessary litigation because of sloppy work. These processes will be finalized from the moratorium, and they will be reported in the final annual report to be issued for 2011-2012. We also need to indicate that as another challenge, the branch continues to experience an increase in complaints from various communities. This is a main range from non-compliance by farm mining companies on implementation of social labor plan commitments. There are another challenges, disputes within some communities relating to implementation of local economic development initiatives, as well as the fact that this impedes effective implementation of socioeconomic development within those communities. The other aspect which is a challenge is funding, and I wouldn't want to spend a lot of time on this because it was raised over and over again during the presentations that we made. On the next slide, we just needed to indicate in simple terms what the impact of capacity constraints arising from the situation which we find ourselves translate into. To show that if you were to take a typical large region, that may, if you were to look at the horizon in terms of from 2004 to where we are now, it would have received 5,200 applications, and on average they would process around 700 of those. And if you consider that in a year you have 220 working days, it then would require that if you need to do work thoroughly, it requires that there has to be 3 in-depth evaluations of each application per day. And as long as 50% of those were to be granted, which means the decisions are positive, it translates into around 2,600 inspections that need to be required to enforce compliance. And in line with the conditions and terms of the right, it implies that once every 2 years, 1,300 of this inspection need to be conducted. So if you add that together with what obtains in a year, it then calls for 6 inspections per day. So, and if you look at the kind of capacity that we have in some of the regions, where the technical discipline, sometimes you have 1 or 2 officials for mine economy, social labor plan, BEE, etc. What this implies in simple language is that there will be serious capacity constraints, and it has an impact in terms of being able to do some of the things we desire to do. So to those who evaluate applications and enforce compliance at an appropriate level with the current capacity becomes challenging. There is a particular volumetric study that was done into the capacity needs of the branch, and it really indicated clearly that we require additional resources. and funding requests were made and are constantly being made to National Treasury, you know, for the resources that we require. As a corrective measure, in conclusion, Chair, I just need to flag that we constantly engage with National Treasury, you know, with a view of seeking assistance with funding so that we can fund the compliance unit that we have in place. On the other hand, we have also implemented a new electronic system for the lodgement and efficient administration of mining and prospecting rights. We have moved to also strengthen the capacity for our regional offices also by increasing the number of chief directors that oversee regional offices. And also, we have initiated a process of, you know, rotating our regional managers as part of growing the skills base, because we have a challenge and also need to invest in skills development. We have increased the rate of enforcement and compliance inspections, as is evident in the annual report in terms of the targets that we normally set for compliance inspections. I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
My presentation will be very brief, as I've already been minimally covered by the DG. So I'll focus mainly on the success points and a few challenges. So without much ado, I'll start with the slide which is up in front of you there. The Geoscience Amendment Act of 16 of 2010 was signed into law in December 2010. And I'm doing this quick thing because I know that the members have already had for the presentation advance and they have the annual report in front of them. And then the Mining Industry Growth and Development and Employment Trustee stakeholders signed a declaration on the sustainable development, sustainable growth and development and meaningful transformation of the mining industry in June of the reporting financial year, that is 2010. 2010-2011, and the review charter came into effect also on the 13th of September 2010. A mining sector strategy was also developed on the signed declaration by the MIGDEL stakeholders. And Cabinet has also approved that we select African Exploration and Mining Finance Corporation as the nucleus for the establishment of the state-owned mining company. And we have also made a small dent, albeit not extensive, in terms of rehabilitating successfully five asbestos mines. And the Department of Mineral Resources has also hosted the African Diamond Producers Association Council of Ministers in 2010 with our Minister Honorable Shawangu as the chairperson of that organization. And we have, in our routine and day-to-day work, we have successfully built strategic partnerships with various organizations, amongst them Bureau of Petroleum Research in Stellenbosch, and the Raw Materials Group and the Commodities Research Group, which support us in our research work. And we continue also to educate and communicate with stakeholders on targets for stakeholder engagement. And the department and the branch together continue to promote investment in the mineral sector by the various engagements that they attend here and abroad. We have also been participating in a number of interventions around job creation, and we all observed this morning our DG talked to mineral beneficiation work that is gaining much traction and advancing very satisfactorily. And we also are promoting, as the branch,
the sustainable use of resources. And we've also done two study reports that were completed as mineral intelligence reports, which will show themselves in our publications, amongst them that you would be familiar with, South African Mining Industry Publication, annual one, and various short-term ones like quarterly bulletin. We are also busy with developing environmental policies in engagement with other government departments. I think some of that work will be coming through as we do the necessary consultations with sister departments such as the Department of Environmental Affairs. And then the challenges, amongst others, that, well, we didn't discuss in detail. We have the MPRD Amendment Bill, which is currently in the process of being consulted about with the other government departments. On beneficiary strategy, a lot has been said already. And on small-scale mining strategy, that is still some lot of work to be done there, as it was said also in the morning. And then as far as the MPRD bill is concerned, it will be introduced to the cabinet as soon as we obtain the state law advisor's preliminary certificate. And our term beneficiation, again, it has been covered extensively. Small-scale mining has been developed and is, as the DG reported, is due to be submitted to our principals with a proper formal submission document-wise. And I would like to thank you, honorable members, and it's not that I'm skimping, but I take it that you've had four deliver of the presentation itself, and the annual report is here. And, of course, we are happy to entertain any questions together as this team as may arise from what you've done.
Thank you very much. There you are, honorable members. Let's not waste any further time. Remembering that the program directors are going to come back to us in terms of their annual reports, isn't it? Individually. Is that not so? They're going to come back to us. I think we did receive somewhat five annual reports. Mintech, Geoscience, Mine Health and Safety. Who else is there? Jay? Yeah, the entities. The entities are going to be coming back. So you can spend time on corporate services because they will not be back. They are part of the main report. But it's open to you. It's open to you, really. I'm not restricting any questions to anyone. I'm just flagging that fact. Tetan, Honorable Zondo? Okay. Shoot for now.
Chairperson, I would ask one question from the last presentation. On your successes, you are saying 82 SMMEs were supported. But to me, that doesn't say anything if we do not know how are they performing currently, those SMMEs. Was it a once-off support, or is it a continuous support until they are on their feet? But also, on the same vein, you are saying small-scale mining strategy is still needed. Now, I think I observe a contradiction there, but I stand corrected. Thank you.
Thank you very much. On program one, administration, slide number 5 on batteries. You've highlighted the 17 girl learners. Does it end there? And how are they progressing as well? So that we can then have a feel, because we need to promote the participation of women in this industry as vigorously as we can possibly do. And then on program 1-1, on program 1-1, there seems to be a success story reflected here in terms of targets that were set. Could this be a reflection of low targets that were set, or what basically is happening? Because on slide 5, you're indicating the target was 10% and you achieved 12%. And also, instead of 5 internal processes identified, 13 were reviewed and implemented, which is quite a substantial number in terms of the targets and the successes thereof. Can you take us into your confidence? Yes, you can.
At the same time, there's also the issue of them facing a challenge in terms of the retaining of learners. I think we've asked this question before as to, is there nothing that they can put into place, pressure that they can put into place, that the people they offer bursaries and learnerships to have a way of being restricted to at least give a service in return for a certain period of time. Then I have also a challenge in terms of the way the, I once said that the way the training entity is being conducted is such that it appears as though it's only mine health and safety that prioritizes issues of training, whereas issues of training should be more central, especially in the corporate services, human resource development, it's part of HRM. And it doesn't really come out clearly as to the relationship. You are mentioning somewhere that you do get an indication that you are working on your workplace skills plan, but at the same time you then say you are dependent on bursaries. Is it just about bursaries that they're dependent on M2A for, or is it your program as a whole in terms of an assessment that you would have done in terms of the skills development that you require from the department? That is why I have a challenge in terms of you continuously stressing the fact that your skills development seems to be a focus for mind, health and safety rather than an issue that goes into human part of the human resource management sector. Then it goes to the issue of their employment equity stats. I hear what the report is saying here in terms of their achievements, but more detail is needed in us trying to balance out the very issue of women, disabled people, and how they're being accommodated. There might be an improvement in terms of percentages, but the actual numbers and the actual people involved, is it satisfactory? That's a question that remains with one. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Mine health and safety, we're going to deal with you when you come back, but just on one issue or two. One is the conversion of single-sex hostels in slide 10 and the integration. We know that you've got your target of 2014 having eradicated. Just to get a feel of whether you're getting there, because in areas where we have been, we've come across this phenomenon of single-sex hostels, and there appears that in some companies nothing is being done. So just a feel. But on a more, you know, concerned area of summits. You're talking of HIV TB summit. You made a reference to another summit that will be held. And I don't know, do you really need summits or do you need to simply enforce compliance? Because you had one summit by the council, which set milestones. Now, do you need another summit to set other milestones, or do you really need to implement what has been agreed upon? but we'll come back to you on a number of other areas. I think those are the ones. And on program 3, it's a similar situation. On your slide 5, exceeding target. Now, you're not saying here by how much and what was the level of target that was set, except that there is a success story of the targets being exceeded. So we can't say whether, again, here the targets were set low so that it's an easily achievable target or what was the situation. And I think that would be it. And time constraints. Okay. Any other question, honorable members? Nothing. Please respond to those.
Thanks, Chair. I think I've been talking the whole morning. Let me allow the colleagues to respond to that.
Okay. I think the first question was directed to me from Honorable Sonto, and thank you, Chairperson. On the small, medium enterprises, it is a cumulative figure over a period of about 3 years, and that figure includes small scale miners. It also includes beneficiation projects. So the support there is such excess that we make them sustainable and viable over a long period. To some of the interventions that were mentioned around, especially not necessarily financial, in terms of training and giving the jobs, we have the, quite a number of them in the those provinces which are most disadvantaged. I think simply as long as the school, etc. And then we have quite a lot of work being done in the Northern Cape. My colleagues report back to me. So it's a cumulative figure over the period to the time we are reporting this financial year. And then as far as the small-scale mining strategy that perhaps I apologize that it could have been anything normal. What I could have meant, I wanted to say there are still certain issues that we need to research and trash out thoroughly, especially around the issue of compliance by the small-scale miner when it comes to air environmental management and things like that, as well as also, they themselves also not being just fly by night. We want to see how can we avoid in the future that these small-scale miners who have been getting assistance are using that financial assistance appropriately. You know, we see the fruit in the long time. We don't just see somebody was given 1.8 million. Tomorrow, he's got nothing to show for it. It was in that context that I said these are some of the issues that we just need to finally tie up in the strategy. That's what I meant, you know.
Thank you. I would like to respond to the two issues based on the presentation of Program 1.1 on the achievement of exceeding of the set target. The first one, which is 12% against the 10% set target, is on the registered HDSA registered in the database. This is actually informed by the number of potential service providers who, when we have advertised that we are open for them to can be part of the database from which we will source our quotations, they complete the forms and send them through. So this is actually informed by the number of people who responded. So instead of the 10% that we have anticipated or said, they exceeded and they went to 10%. The next one on the number of internal processes that were set against those that were achieved, which is 13. This is considerably because of the fact that by the time we set this target, we base them on the history and what is there at the time. And by the time we did these projections, we only had 5 in mind. But after the audit, there were some processes that we were compelled to have to review them to align them to what we were committing to address certain issues. So this pulled that to safety that we never actually, never anticipated in trying to address those issues. Thank you.
On the issue of bursaries for girl learners, I think at the time of reporting it was 17 girl learners, which was a project that was launched only this year, around June. So we started off with 17. I think where we're sitting right now is plus minus 20 or 21 or so. So we've managed to, we're hoping to increase that by, you know, every year, you know, because the target, I think, is the mining companies. So, you know, we're trying to get more of them to contribute towards this project. This is now with bursaries pertaining to the girl learners, but then the other bursaries that I referred to, the mine health and safety bursaries from the MGA. And the reason why we emphasize in mine health and safety is where we have a very, very big challenge, where we bring people in, but before they can even complete the program, because we have an in-house training program that we run with them. Before they can even complete, I think they get discouraged along the way, and then they exit the program. And we've had challenges in that area. That's why, you know, when we talk about bursaries, I think we're focusing more on the mind health, because that's where we have a challenge. But we do have internal bursaries that we offer to the employees. We've just completed the adjudication process now for our internal employees. We also have training that is ongoing for our employees. How this happens is during the performance appraisals, the managers have to identify the kind of training or development that the employees need. And then they come to the human resources management or the HRD development component to request training for their people. So that is also ongoing. It's training that is ongoing in the department. And I think the reason why we're not referring to that is that it's an ongoing process that we've always had and it's still going on. In terms of the reason why I want to highlight the EDP is that it's where we have a lot of, you know, it's a huge investment for the department, and it's at the senior management level. We identify senior managers to go on to the executive development program with the Vets University. It's an intensive, very intensive program. That's why I think most of the time, you know, we refer to those development programs, but it's safe to say that we also do have other development programs within the department. On the employment equity steps, I can refer you to page 196 to 199 of the annual report. This is where we have all the steps. You know, women actually, our target for women actually we've exceeded our targets. We have far more women in the department than we have males. And on the disabled, we have a challenge. You know, the national target, I think, is 1% of your complement and the staff complement of a department. And I think that's where we at least struggling a bit as a department, but we are focusing on that. And we're also cognizant of the fact that we are unable to accept other race groups, especially colors and Indians, for some strange reason. And we're going on a recruitment drive to target them, and this means going through maybe, preferences in media, where they, you know, the media kind of papers that they read, or even headhunt, you know, going through the headhunting process to be able to at least meet the target of other race groups, as I said, in particular colors and Indians.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the single sex hostel, in terms of the recently reviewed mining charter, it has identified the living conditions as a problem. And we do agree some of the mines are still having a problem in achieving their targets. In our engagement with our colleagues, we'll be working together with our other branches to make sure that they fast track. We clearly indicated to some of the CEOs that we expect them to fast track on this, because there's far-reaching implications, not only with the mine employees, but the labor-sending areas as well. Eastern Cape, Lesotho, or southern countries. In fact, some of the ministers out there are complaining that South Africa is exporting TB. And we believe that one of the low-hanging fruits is really to deal with this particular aspect. I will work with the other colleagues and the industry to make sure that we deal with it. And lastly, with the summit, it is a legal provision of the Mine Health and Safety Act that we must hold every second year a summit to review the progress that has been made in terms of the actions that have agreed upon. Remember, Honourable Ms. Bigan indicated her concern regarding the 110 decibel. It's one of the things that we'll also be looking at in terms of that review. The same thing with the TB and HIV one. We'll also be looking at the progress that has been made by the industry in that regard. Thank you, Chair.
With regard to target setting and actual performance, far exceeding set targets in some cases, creating a perception of setting targets too low to overachieve. What I need to indicate, Chair, Honourable Chair, and Honourable Members, is that the targets that were set, and or rather, actual performance in this case is a function of a number of aspects. One, the period covered by the report under review also included the moratorial period. So in respect of audits that we need to conduct vis-a-vis the set targets, you honorable members would realize that we exceeded those in some cases by almost 200-300%, precisely because the focus was on the inspections. And what we started seeing when we embarked on compliance inspection and enforcement was the spin-off also with regard to improvement on other attributes relating to compliance, i.e. your social and labor plan, some of the LED projects also coming on board. But going forward, in line with our revised or new strategic plan, we sought to firm up on target setting, so that it does not also begin to create a picture of trying to overachieve through setting targets as low as possible. Thanks.
I think that handles the areas that you had asked. Unless there are other questions from honourable members, we have eaten into your time. Some of you have left already. So I don't know. I'm in your hands. If there are outstanding questions, especially if they are not towards those that are coming back. Okay. All right. Let's thank you very much. And the process that will follow here now is that we would want honorable members to familiarize themselves with this BRRR guidelines, which would be a repeat of what we have done last year. So next week we are expected to present to you a draft BRRR report before dealing with the business of the day. And let's thank the department for having presented the two reports submissions in terms of the of reporting on the financial performance as well as non-financial performance. Even though you have technically reported to have two successive qualified reports, in reality you have one. This is your first report as DMR, in which case we need to then encourage you to work harder. We've registered improvements in terms of what was raised last year at the time you were still DME, and you've registered quite some improvements in those areas. And we will highlight some of the areas in our BRRR recommendations. But for now, I think we are satisfied with the answers that you have provided, and that, as we have indicated, we will engage further with the entities in terms of their annual reports. We will try and do that within the first month of our coming back next year after the December holiday. Otherwise, our program is full between now and the beginning of December. Unless there would be cancellation by one of the entities that we have invited for reasons that are valid, and then we may request one of the entities to come through, but you will be notified timeously for that eventuality. I hope that you have the acting DG a copy of our program on matters of transformation that you have referred to here. We're going to be engaging on the 2nd and the 9th with the captains of the industry. We've invited 10 CEOs of the top 10 mining companies to come and talk to us on transformation, mainly using the measurement tool called the Mining Charter, both the old version as well as the amended charter, because we don't seem to get the reliable and factual information out of the umbrella body. You presented as the department, you gave us your figures, they were immediately disputed by the Chamber of Mines, and in turn, their figures were disputed by other presenters that followed. So we felt that we needed these companies so that we can deal with them. So it would be important if you, as the department, are there to observe.